You are listening to station WGN.
Oh, a microphone!
And a phony at the mic! Whoa!
And radio became an accepted vehicle for nationwide news and opinion.
Notify all radio and TV stations to broadcast the following message.
Oh, is that the comedy spot?
No, Bubblehead, this is a comedy spot.
You're a fun guy, Dave. You're lonely on an island.
What a dope. What a maroon.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is exciting, isn't it?
In 5, 4, 3, 2.
Look back at the last year continues as we listen to Dave Flyer's favorite conversations of the year. Part 2 on 720 WGN. And now, live from the Allstate Skyline Studios, here's Dave.
Thank you, Duff. Roger, good morning to you.
And good morning to you.
Curtis, good morning to you as well.
Good morning.
What a beautiful day today.
Yeah, it was.
I mean, just gorgeous. In fact, I feel kind of silly that I didn't take down my Christmas decorations outside.
Still haven't?
Well, you know, you're supposed to keep them up till, what is it, tomorrow or a week from Sunday? I can't remember which day it is. From a faith thing.
I thought it was the 6th, which is today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But today's going to be, you're going to be busy. You got other things.
Too busy.
Yeah,
we did a lot of the house stuff today, which I must say took forever because, we start like decorating November 1st. So kind of pull everything together. And then we're like going to leave a box open kind of in the storage area because there's always things we find like 2 hours later. Like, here's another one rolled underneath the table or something. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. here's a wooden soldier. Whatever.
You have more stuff than a museum. Seriously. Hmm. To be stored away for the holidays.
Yeah, well, you know, and we actually got rid of a lot of stuff this year, too. We went through and said, okay, we have never put this up, or we got this as a gift from the Badishes. We're never going to use this.
Wait, what?
Or we got a... No, we went through a lot of things that, like, we use at our old house. It doesn't really fit anything anymore. Right. And it just needed to go, like, no sentimental value on, mm-hmm. On some of these things. So we just said, okay, it's good. We'll donate it to Catholic Charities or someplace and get it over to somebody so they can use it and have some good use out of it. Absolutely. I love doing these favorite conversation shows of the year. And let me just tell you who we have on today.
Okay.
We have Johnny Galecki from Big Bang Theory because it's the last season
that
we had him on. Kevin Bacon. He was here in Chicago over the summer, and it was just a great conversation with him, and we also talked a little bit about Footloose, because why can't you? Of course. Gene Simmons from Kiss. An interesting interview at best. I mean, he's pretty opinionated guy.
Extremely.
And speaks his mind mm-hmm. and all that good stuff, but just a cool guy as well. Bob Odenkirk from Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad, and mm-hmm. a Chicagoan, too, and we had a great time talking to him. We've got a conversation with John Records Landecker and Bob Surratt because there's a Dick Biondi biopic being made, and those two not only are a part of the conversation, but they also worked with Dick and back in the days of mm-hmm. when WLS was a real radio station and all that good stuff. And then we're going to tack onto our podcast a few favorites that we don't have time to air tonight, and that's Tim Matheson. From Animal House, music icon Frankie Avalon and comedian Jimmy Walker. And maybe we'll fit some of those in over the next few weeks. But those are our conversations for today. Now, we're going to have all new stuff starting next week. And
okay.
I have two things lined up so far that I'm really, both of them very excited about.
Would I drool over them?
I think so. Okay. Stevie Van Zandt.
Ooh.
From Springsteen.
Wow. And Springsteen is so hot now with his Broadway and the documentary.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And also, The Sopranos have made a return to HBO. They're rolling through all the seasons right now.
So
he was Silvio Dante. He was on the Sopranos as well. But he's got this really cool thing about he's taking music and really some of the lyrics and the history of music and turning into some curriculum for schools. So not teaching really so much about music, but the mm-hmm. meaning of the time of those songs, what they meant, and then history tied into them.
That's nice.
He's got some really cool stuff going on, so we're going to talk to him about that. And then from ABC 7, my pal Cheryl Scott is going to join us.
Oh, that's great.
Yes, I love Cheryl. I mean, believe me, I'm a big Tom Skilling fan. I know. It's WGN, of course. But Cheryl's just lovely.
Yes, she is.
And talented.
Would you say adorable?
Me?
Yeah.
Oh, yes, of course. I would say, yeah, I thought you meant...
Well, you are adorable. You are adorable.
No, that's what I thought. Yeah. Embarrass myself. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You're embarrassing me now, Roger.
Well, that's okay. You need to be embarrassed once in a while.
All right, so first up, here's my conversation with Johnny Galecki from Big Bang Theory.
It all started with a Big Bang. It's expanding ever out.
Big Bang Theory is about to enter its final season on CBS. Johnny Galecki is the star of the show, who also starred in Roseanne and made an appearance in the recent reboot. He's a Chicago guy through and through, and he joins us tonight. Hey, Johnny.
Hey, David. How are you? Thanks so much for having me, man.
Absolutely. Thanks for hanging out with us. Well, first, congratulations on a long run on The Big Bang Theory, almost 12 seasons in the making. And just think, it all started in Chicago. But you were born in Belgium. So when did you and your family make your way to Oak Park?
I think I want to say it was about 2.5 or 3, actually. We lived in, he went back to school in Michigan, but we ended up there in Oak Park, I'd say about 4 or 5 years old.
So what do you remember about the city as a kid, besides Mark Giangreco, which you just mentioned to me before the call started?
I did. It was one of my first questions, wasn't it? Yes, it was. Mark Giangreco still around causing trouble.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Mark Giangreco.
That's the first thing on your list.
You know, it was a big change from an Air Force base in Belgium and a big change from living in the sticks out in Allegan, Michigan. So, you know, the fact that there was a fire hydrant outside the house was fascinating, right? Never mind stoplights and what have you.
Yeah. Do you remember, I mean, what did you used to do? Did you used to hang out in the city? Did you ever go to Kiddyland? Like, what are some of your fondest memories of being a kid in Chicago?
Oh, we did go to Kiddyland, yes. Yeah, there was quite a bit of, and then my mother had gone to Kiddyland. That was just a statue for that area, certainly.
Since the 1920s, and it closed about, you know, 3 years ago.
At that age, we're talking 4 or 5, just to have a neighbor was a big deal.
Right,
But, you know, there was the community that Chicago is, and especially the neighborhoods in Chicago is. There were block parties, there were holiday parties, there was Christmas caroling, which is unheard of nowadays for whatever reason. So, all of that started to sink into me, and then later... The Chicago theater community, which is just as supportive as your next door neighbors, was obviously a massive influence on me, and really made it able for me to do what I still do today, 33 years later.
That's very cool. Do you still have friends and family here? Do you visit once in a while?
Yes, all my family is there.
Oh,
yeah,
that's great.
As much as possible.
That's
great. In a few days, as a matter of fact.
Beautiful, beautiful.
And I love it. Even in this time of year, I love it. Right. I know it drives people there crazy because they say, you need to deal with it, this weather, for 4 days. We deal with it for 4 months.
Right, exactly. But it's fun to come back here and see it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Fair enough. I get to say, wow, this is really pretty, and they just want to throttle me immediately. But it is beautiful there. And those those windows, and sometimes they're much too brief of spring and fall, obviously. There's no place I'd rather be. No. And outside of those windows, as my mother said, Chicago has 2 seasons, summer and construction.
Very true.
Winter and construction.
That's totally true. That's totally true. Now, I heard you talk about this before, and I think it was on Letterman. And you know, when you're in a city like this, yeah, Everyone gives everyone a nickname. And I had several myself.
True.
Yeah, I had several myself that...
Oh, what are some? Give me a couple of them.
My last name's Plyer.
Share with the audience.
It was Peeler. It was Pilfer. It was Piler. It was, I got a lot of DPs, you know, which also they made fun of. That would be dumb Pollock as well,
win.
Which
you
I am.
Really,
no, you can't really win. What was yours?
Well, I think that was Conan, where we were talking.
It was Conan. It was Conan.
So the Conan at the Chicago Theater there, which was a really thrilling night. My God, I mean. The crowd was, what is this Chicago Theater there hold, like 3,000?
Yeah.
Or something like that?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I get nervous still when I do those darn panel shows. I mean, at the end of the day, I enjoy surviving them.
Right.
But I'm sleepless for a week before Letterman, for example. And so, but you'd walk out on some stage at a place like Chicago Theater, and with the history that place has, and the energy of the crowd, you don't have to do much, man.
But
you just,
there's
you
always excitement, though.
Their energy wave.
Yeah, we don't see you know, like the big Hollywood stars here in Chicago. So when we see you here and we know you're appearing someplace, we get excited.
Well, I don't know. I think that was more for Conan than me, but thank you very much. But it was lovely to be able to have my family there in support of one of those things. My great aunt, who was in her 90s at the time, was there. That was a wonderful night. That nickname that we discussed was for me, that was for a couple of years there, it was Bitfingers, which I still have no...
Bitchfingers, which...
I have no clue why that was the... Why that was the case?
Who gave you? Who gave you that name?
Masculine fingers.
Yeah,
a bartender named Boosh.
Okay, so another guy with another nickname.
There were also many other, as you said. There was, of course, there's the Go Lucky or Happy Go Lucky, or you know, when you have a name like Johnny, you get a lot of songs. Sunday, you get Johnny Good and Johnny Angel, and it's pretty endless.
Yeah, I bet it is. I bet it is. Well, how did you get into acting? Because I don't think you went to school for it. You were like 11 or 12 when you first got your first gig in a mini series. How did you get into it?
I started talking about it about the time that we moved there to Chicago, and you know, my father worked there he taught blind veterans at Heinz VA Hospital outside of the city.
Okay.
And my mother was a mother and a housewife. There was nobody in my immediate family that could have been of any influence. I honestly have no idea how I even knew the word actor at 3.5 years old. But that was my answer when adults asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up. And my parents, they weren't unsupportive by any means, just didn't know what to do with this odd ambition and their child, so they kind of hoped it would pass, I think, and tried to distract me with soccer and t-ball and things of that nature, which was just an embarrassing failure. At t-ball, I would strike out up at mound. There's a ball right there, and I was on the tee. I would strike out, and when we were in the field, I was the catcher. There's no pitcher in t-ball, so basically, I was kind of like a waiter that kind of picks up your dropped fork and place it back.
But it's a sports city, though.
There you are, sir.
It's a sports city, though. You had to try it, you know.
It had to try, absolutely. Yeah. And then come 7 years old, we were sitting around a dinner table, and my parents were reading the Oak Leaves, the suburban newspaper there, but for the West Suburbs. I'm not sure if it, I believe it does still exist.
It does, yeah.
And there was an ad for open auditions for a community theater production of Fiddler on the Roof, what was then the Village Players on South Boulevard. And they explained, you know, this is what actors need to do to get a job. The phone doesn't just ring. Do you want to go and watch people audition and learn what that is? And we did, and I ended up jumping up on stage and singing something and got a very small chorus role in the production. But from that point on, the people in that production helped my parents learn what it would take to learn about photos and agents, if I was ever so lucky, and things of that nature. And that's what I mean by that's my first example of a million of how supportive that Chicago theater community is.
That's great. So I didn't know you actually started in the theater here. That's what a cool experience as a young kid. And I love the fact
that... Yeah, I did that show, and then I think I did I think next was a production of Pippin, which was downtown, which was a big deal.
Sure.
And then a production of Remember the Wedding, which I was nominated for a Joseph Jefferson Award. And that's the agents coming by to see that performance, and I think that garnered me my first agent, which resulted in some commercials and industrial films, and I'm putting myself on tape for things that were being produced in Los Angeles.
Yeah, and you were like 14, and you were pretty much living alone out there. I mean, you were getting roles and you were getting parts while your folks were back here, your family was back here, and you were out there kind of hitting the streets and doing what you had to do to make a name for yourself.
Yeah, well, we had all moved out there when I was about 13, and honestly, that lasted about 9 or 10 months. We really missed Chicago. And by the time that we found another house back home and were ready to move back, I was under contract, and it was supposed to be for a very short amount of time, and that was some years ago.
Gotcha. Now, just a couple years later, you know, you landed in what AMC listed this year as the number 2 most favorite holiday movie behind It's a Wonderful Life, if you can believe that. It's Christmas Vacation.
Crazy?
How cool is that?
Amazing.
Yeah.
It was amazing, and it was completely unforeseen. I mean, like I said, my agency at the time, we had started to put ourselves, put me on tape and send it on out, but that was exciting just to know, that in itself, to know that someone in Los Angeles, someone in Hollywood was watching my tape, was watching my audition right. tape. And so the expectations were low. And on that, when I booked the role on Christmas Vacation, I was still living in Chicago. And
oh, okay.
It was that simple situation. They sent in a tape and that I had made, and casting liked it, and they flew me out to Los Angeles, and I read with Chevy Chase and Jeremiah Chesick, the director, and Chevy gave me the role that day. It was really just wow. a kind of whirlwind dream come true experience.
You joined Roseanne in the fourth season, and I would imagine Roseanne was very involved in the audition process, because she cast you, you know, in the role of David as Sarah Gilbert's character and Darlene's mm-hmm. love interest. That must have been an amazing experience.
Yeah, you know, I didn't audition for that. That wasn't a role that Rose or the writers had written, and then they did the kind of traditional orthodox process of reading actors. I had done a television movie with Roseanne called Backfield in Motion. It was only our best work, the two of us.
Okay.
But we hit it off. We played mother and son, and she asked me to come on and do one episode of Roseanne. I had three lines on it and the credit tag, and then she asked me to do three more episodes, and then she asked me to do 3 years, and it turned into almost 100 episodes.
But even back then, your timing, your comedic timing, and I know you do dramatic stuff as well, but I mean, your comedic timing at that age was very entertaining. I mean, it was always funny to watch your character on that show.
Well, thank you. I mean, I, you're right. I didn't go to school for it, and I didn't really. In fact, a lot of people at that time suggested to my parents and myself that they not send to any sort of classes, because whatever was happening, you know, was happening. There wasn't sure. a problem at hand, so sure. wasn't anything to fix. Which was, I think, you know, I've always said that I consider myself a comedic actor. It's funny now. I've done so much comedy. I've been so fortunate to do so many comedic projects that people come up to me on the street and ask what comedy club I started in. I said, oh my God, no, I can't. I can't imagine. That's a whole different sport. But I would never ever.
But what a compliment! What a compliment, though. You know.
Absolutely, yeah. But it's just funny to me. I mean, I've always felt that, you know, that if it's funny on the page, then you play the honesty of it.
Yeah.
And if there was some unique timing that I had at that age, I think it was really just natural. I mean, I hadn't really come from, you know, my influences were very different than other kids. My influences were not sports figures or even the other kids in the schoolyard that might be, you know, a year or two older than them. They were always the guys in the chorus line I was working with at 7 years old.
Sure.
Or, you know, the actors I had watched and performed scenes with. Or the other, at that point, the comic actors, and some of them legendary, and Chevy Chase and Rick Clayde. And so, I mean, that was just kind of in me in some sort of, those were my heroes.
Yeah.
Of course I wanted to emulate them.
Well, you had
but
a great.
I don't know how designed it was as an artist at 10, 11, 12, 13 years old.
That makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense. And you talk about legends that you work with. I've also heard you talk about a story about being with Milton Berle, and he was teaching you how to make out. Explain that, would you please?
Yeah, he had a lot of advice.
Yeah, I'm sure he did.
Which is basically kind of perform an upside-down triangle with your eyes.
Okay.
A woman, look them in the eye, the mouth, the eye, the eye, the mouth. And next thing you know, you're making out. He wasn't wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
I've put it into practice. He was a very smart man.
And he was on Roseanne?
Very productive man. He was. I think he may have even done more than one episode. I'm not sure. And he actually did an episode in drag, which, you know, for decades he had refused to do because it becomes such a legendary
sure.
bit that he had done, especially when he did it. It was so, it really pushed the boundaries. But he did. He did it for Roseanne, which was, I can't imagine how flattered Rose was for that.
And you've done countless movies and TV appearances. And in 2007, you know, not a lot of people can say they have been on two hit television series. And you became the star of one of TV's most successful sitcoms on the Big Bang Theory. And what originally attracted you to the role to do another sitcom?
Honestly, it was the idea that the character would be struggling with love. You know, I haven't gotten many of those roles, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. You know, I've played the love interest, best friend, or a gay assistant, or something like that.
Right, so right. Yeah.
It was uncharted territory for me to be given that opportunity. And that's why initially, before they had more than a scene or two written, the producers talked to me about doing the role of Sheldon. I said, you know, I'm kind of much more attracted to this role for this reason. And I'm not saying that, you know, at that time, I certainly didn't know that the Leonard and Penny characters would be successful in the ways of love. But I knew that that's what that character would be struggling with.
But you
and
knew-
that really attracted to it to me. When you think that way, you have to think best and worst case scenario. You know, you could be doing this for a number of years playing this role, and it's going to need to be something that is going to be fun and interesting and challenging.
I was going to say, as an actor,
every week for what could be a decade of your life.
That's what I have to think. Yeah, that's what I have to think, is that, you know, as an actor, you want something
being
that's not
self-protective. Yeah. I mean, the chances are that you're not going to be. But I knew that if that was the case, then that would have me galvanized every week to do the best job, to give it 110% every day.
Feels a lot more like July. Tonight she's just over. Lie after lie after lie. She puts on my top petty t-shirt. She lets her tear fall. This feeling is familiar. Seems like I've cried these tears before. Just as old as those old t-shirts in the bottom of.
So most people would agree that there's nothing stronger than the bond between two brothers. And when that bond includes the common goal of making music, the results often offer reason for an audience to sit up and take notice. Like the Everly Brothers to Oasis and the Beach Boys to the Kinks, audiences have embraced the brother band, the Bacon Brothers. With 8 albums under their belt, including the newest release, Tom Petty's T-shirt, which you heard coming in, the Bacon Brothers are heading to Chicago for a concert at City Winery on Thursday, July 12th. And joining us to talk about it all is musician and actor Kevin Bacon, well known on the big screen for movies like Footloose, A Few Good Men, A River Gone Wild, Apollo 13th, and recently on the small screen in The Following, and singer, songwriter, musician, and film score composer Michael Bacon. Good morning to you guys.
Hey, good morning.
How you doing?
I am doing all right. You know, you guys have been working together on stage for just over 20 years, and as brothers, you know, brothers working together, siblings working together, spouses working together can be really tough. You guys haven't killed each other yet.
No, we're getting there, though. Any moment now.
Death. That's great. The chemistry on stage speaks for itself. I saw you guys at the Arcata in 2015, and I was blown away. I mean, fans know you, Kevin, for all your film work, Michael, and composing and all your work. So when you see two guys out of the comfort zone that, as a fan, that you're used to seeing them with, it could be pretty different. But I will tell you, it was very cool, Kev.
We like to go on the premise that most people coming to the show think we're going to be terrible. and when you start with that, it's part of our job to, you know, surprise people, and hopefully, if they haven't seen the show before, leave as, you know, fans of the music, and not just, you know, movies.
Yeah. Well, you guys grew up in Philly, and I know it wasn't just the two of you. You have four other sisters. Was music always an element in your life, or when did you find interest? I'll start with you, Michael.
Well, yeah, I can't remember a time where I wasn't interested in it, and we grew up in a household that valued the arts and creativity above everything else. Our parents had, my father designed the townhouse that we grew up in kind of a mid-century with an absolutely gorgeous sound system, and the music they listened to was really eclectic. It was Broadway shows and world music and the Weavers and folk and classical, and I was really soaked it all up at a very early age. And then our sisters became Bobby Soxer, and there's a lot of rock and roll and 45 RPM records and stuff like that all over the house. So it was all over the place.
Kevin, what about you? What was kind of the big moment for you that you wanted to have music as a part of your life?
Well, it's interesting, you know, you learn about things when you do interviews. I think probably because of the 9-year age difference between us,
mm-hmm.
the music that I was influenced by was not my parents' music as much as it was the music of my siblings.
That's cool.
Music that they were making and the music that they were bringing home. I have a vague kind of memory of show tunes and folk and classical, but it was really, really about, you know, Michael was already, and my sister were already in bands when I was a little kid, and they were playing in jug bands, and they were bringing home, you know, 45s of British Invasion, and Michael was a, you know, singer-songwriter, you know, later on, you know, composing, writing songs, in the, you know, down the hall, and so that's the stuff that was the most influential on me.
Now, you mentioned, both of you mentioned that, you know, it was really in your household, you know, brought into your household, entertainment and music and so forth. Live theater was a big part of that. Was there some stage productions that you saw as a kid, Michael, that really influenced you and thought, yeah, this is pretty cool?
Well, one of the things that was kind of neat about our dad is he had this model theater, and it was from Copenhagen, and they were very, very elaborate sets, and he had these incredible amounts of lights and kind of special effects and stuff, and he would get the scripts for one of the shows, like, let's say, Little Match Girl, and he'd assemble a bunch of people, and we'd record the soundtrack very casually in the living room, and it was really fun. I always loved doing that.
So you had this stuff in the house?
Yeah, he had, in the basement, he had this whole model theater set up.
It was kind of like a little tiny mini theater with cardboard, like cutout cardboard figures that you kind of move on
these. That's cool.
He flips them around, and it was his main hobby in his whole life.
He loved
that little theater.
Wow, very cool. When it comes to all the music, Kev, who does most of the writing?
We're pretty split on it, you know. Generally, if I'm doing the lead vocal, I wrote it, and if Mike's doing the lead vocal, he wrote it, it's pretty even
between the two. What's the process like to pull a song together? And I have to imagine, Michael, that, you know, composing music or instrumental music for a specific scene or a specific film or a TV show that you do in your daily life is probably, and I dare say this, less cumbersome than actually sitting down and writing the song because you're putting lyrics together and everything else.
Less cumbersome by about 10.
Is that right?
You're exactly right. Yeah, going back to our childhood, one of the things I was very lucky is that whatever our parents instilled in my brain musically, I think of it as a tap that I can turn off and on at will. So if I get to sit down in my studio, I can write music continually until I'm too tired. Whereas songwriting is, you know, Kevin and I talk about this all the time, what is it that puts you in the mood? What is the where are you sitting? What kind of guitar do you have? What did you have for breakfast that makes all of a sudden a song appear and take enough and gather enough energy within you to push through and write, you know, all the verses and the choruses and the bridge and everything else? So, yeah, it's a much more torturous kind of process. And, you know, I really feel like if I write a couple of good songs a year, that's about all I really expect of myself. But we're still searching for that magic kind of situation that, you know, that elicits that kind of a response and pushing out a new song.
That makes me want to write a song called Breakfast Burrito.
maybe that's it, man.
That's for the new album, I'm thinking. Yeah, I like that. All artists have different approaches when it comes to performing on stage, because it's, you know, there's a big, obviously big difference for being in a recording studio and doing it and getting it right so you can put it out there. But, you know, where do your heads go, like, when you have to perform? Where do you go mentally, Kev?
You know, I think that you've played this set before. Obviously, we don't switch it up every night. I mean, there's certain things that are a little different. Mm-hmm. So, in the same way that a play is the same script, there's an element of it that's like that in our show. The set order is usually pretty close to what we've done the night before, et cetera. But the difference is that it's never exactly the same, because you're sharing it with this group of people for this night.
Right.
And the venue's going to be different. You know, you can break a string. You can, you know, have some feedback. You can, see somebody in the front row that seems to really, really know the music and that sort of, you know, is inspirational. There's all these factors that change night after night. So there's always that feeling to me, okay, I'm stepping out on stage, and really anything can happen. And that's what keeps it sort of exciting. I mean, I also think that we have our job. We feel like our job is to try to put on a good show and get rid of whatever moods or issues that we may have had, you know, off mm-hmm. stage, and just get out there and do our thing and you know, play well, sing well, you know, find the grooves and give people their money's worth.
I had to bump back in with Footloose. You guys singing Footloose on stage. I can't help myself. You were a good sport and did the Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon a few years back, and you were choreographed in this big version of the song. What's awesome is that I've learned is that over the years, you've really embraced everything you've done in the business, and you still look 20 years younger than you were.
You know, the finest plastic surgeons in Hollywood. Make that happen.
Nice. Tell us a little bit about the new album, A Tip of the Hat to the Late Tom Petty. Michael, let's start with you.
I think it's our best It kind of happened in two spurts. We recorded five songs about a year ago, and we're releasing them as videos, not really thinking in terms of a CD release. And then about, I guess, 6 months ago, we did a gig with G.E. Smith out on...
Oh, yeah.
And he really liked the song I Feel You that Kevin wrote, and he said, I've got some ideas. How about if I produce it? And we said, sure. So we booked the studio that he liked in right outside the Lincoln Tunnel, just in New Jersey, in Secaucus. Is that where it is? No, Weehawken.
Sorry. Okay.
And so it went well with the I Feel You, and the next day we had the studio booked to cut some more stuff, and he said, why don't I just hang around, which he did. So, you know, he helped us get the CD done, and it was really fun to have a different set of ears there, you know, a different aesthetic, coming from a totally different place than all of us are. And so we have this album that you know, is recorded, you know, half a year ago and half recently, and I think it all hangs together really well.
This is your eighth album. You know, Kev, what's the process like for you when you're putting together a new album? Like, you know, obviously there's a sound to what you do. So, you know, what kind of balance do you want on there as far as the songs that you write and choose to put on a new album?
I wish it had all that much planning, you know what I mean? I think it's, we don't really think too much about our sound, per se, and we don't really think too much about, you know, kind of a theme, necessarily, for an album. Because we have two writers in the band, and because there's a really, really wide variety of musical abilities within the guys that play with us. We kind of write the song, and then we let it go in a certain kind of direction.
Hmm.
There's a song on there called The Garden, and it's got two musical elements that none of the other songs have. One is conga drums, and the other is a horn section. There's a song on there called Broken Glass, and it's got a kind of a drum loop, which is also something that we don't use in anything else. So it's really kind of we let the song sort of dictate the sound of the thing, and then we just, you know, kind of throw them in together and come up with an order and see what we're left with.
What about the instruments? Obviously, you know, you guys have gotten familiar on and off stage and probably tinkered with some different things. I mean, what have you kind of experimented with a little bit to add some new things? You mentioned the conga drums. Michael, what other things you guys have kind of played around with yourselves?
Well, one thing that's really neat is our keyboard player, Joe Manona, brought out his saxophone. He's quite an amazing musician. His first family of instruments are woodwinds. His second are brass, and his third are keyboards, which includes the fact that he can qualify as a church organist with, you know, with playing with the pedals with his feet and stuff.
Wow.
So I think that bringing the saxophone into the band is really cool, and we used it on a couple of the cuts in this record. And also we now have a song where we're all playing ukulele, so there's always new stuff, you know, coming in and new ideas, and we're playing this piece we call The Interlude, which is a cello piece that I wrote more in the style of what I would normally write as a composer, where everybody's reading music rather than doing head charts. And that leads into any number of cello songs, depending on the night, and which adds a lot of variety. So every night we could go to any one of five different cello songs after we play this little interlude.
There's such a freedom to doing what you're doing. I mean, I like that you're bringing in some of the things that you do every day just to kind of shake it up a little bit.
Yeah, I'm really trying to do that because it always bothers me, that disconnect, as you asked that question before, between my life as a composer and my life as a singer-songwriter.
Right.
And I like to keep things kind of connected.
Very cool. I always like to talk about a little of the charity things that you guys do. Kevin, you got a charity called 6 Degrees. You and your wife, Kira Sedgwick, and happy anniversary to you guys, by the way. The big 30. You guys are offering to have a chance of a rare evening in New York City with you, complete with a night of dinner and dancing, in order to raise funds. Tell me a little bit about that.
I've had this thing, 6degrees.org, for quite a few years. We've been in a lot of different iterations, but the kind of the fundamental concept of it is that, you know, for good, for people that are out there in the world and in the field, you know, trying to make positive changes in the world or in their communities. And we're building out this new app that, without going into too much detail, will be a way that either celebrities or non-celebrities can kind of use the 6 degrees concept and the game to actually
make
some money or donations or whatever to something that they sort of care about. So the Omaze campaign, which is that kind of funny thing about coming to New York and having dinner and dancing with us, is a way to raise funds for 6 degrees to create this new app.
Awesome. And I heard Kara can kick your butt on the dance floor, too.
She can.
That's
she
awesome. Can.
Everything you've got. You keep on dancing and the room gets hot. You drive us wild, we'll drive you crazy. You say you want to go for a spin. The party's just begun, we'll let you in. You drive us wild, we'll drive you crazy. You keep on shouting, you keep on shouting.
It's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. For true fans of rock and roll, it's hard to imagine a time when Kiss didn't exist. Inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2014, the band is celebrating 45 years on the planet, entertaining generations of fans. Known as rock's ultimate showman, Gene Simmons co-founded the hard rock supergroup Kiss in the early 1970s. And since then, Kiss has sold more than 80 million albums, awarded over 30 gold records, and performed more than 2,000 shows around the world. Late last year, Gene's new 10-CD box set, The Vault, was released and spans from 66 to 2016 with 150 songs that have never been released. Also, a career-spanning single-disc best-of Kiss World was released to coincide with a massive world tour. Gene sang the lead vocals on hits like Rock and Roll All Night, Calling Dr. Love, and A World Without Heroes. And now, out of makeup, Simmons is embarking on his first-ever solo tour with a red-hot backing band to perform some high-octane rock hits and will be performing at the iconic Arcata Theater in St. Charles on Thursday, May 3rd. And joining us to talk about it all is rock and roll legend Gene Simmons. Gene, welcome in, my friend.
Boy, do I feel better. What a build-up. Unbelievable.
What a career, man. I mean, seriously.
I feel like kind of a big deal now.
You are a big deal. Are you kidding me? You're a big deal. Well,
wow.
Well, I got to tell you, I was reading, you're going back on tour with Kiss in July, and this appearance here in Chicago, you've got your own band, you're going to play some hits, but, this is an opportunity also to hear some uniquely obscure stuff as well.
The Gene Simmons Band started kind of as a, life happens to you while you're busy making plans. I was a keynote speaker at a convention in Vancouver called YPO. And so they said, listen, you're going to be speaking, and there are kind of important people there, Prime Minister Trudeau and all kinds of, cool people.
Mm-hmm.
Would you mind getting up on stage and singing a few tunes? And I explained, it's not as easy as that. You got to put a band together and all that, and you guys can't afford Kiss, so I don't know what I can do. Well, they said, listen, here's X amount of dollars. And I said, sure. So I called some pals in Nashville. And we put together a band over the phone and without rehearsing. I told them which tunes I want to play. Without rehearsing, I gave them the key and we just showed up and played. And I will tell you, the word chemistry isn't just something you learn in high school. When you meet people, either you got it or you don't.
Sure.
That's in music, at work, in love, in hate. Either there's chemistry or there isn't. And there was. And it since we started, we've done over 50 shows, headlining rock festivals in Czech Republic, Canada, all over the place. It's grown into quite a thing. Now, I'm not leaving KISS. We're doing great. We're having a great time playing stadiums and arenas, blah, blah, blah. But this Gene Simmons Band thing has become, grown a life of its own. So even, the fans that show up, you got to remember the word fan comes from the word fanatic. Mm-hmm. And so we get a chance to play stuff that KISS will never play, stuff off the solo records. And we've got a 44-year history, obscure stuff off of The Elder. I mean, stuff the fans have been clamoring for.
That's cool.
That KISS can't play. I don't mean physically. I mean, when you got 10 to 50,000 people at a concert, they want to hear what they know.
There's expectations. Yeah, yeah.
Well, absolutely. Sure. If I go see the Stones, I want to hear Satisfaction.
Right.
When they play, when they play something obscure off of a 1995 record, the audience sits down, except for the diehards. So the folks who come to see the Gene Simmons Band are diehards, and they want, special stuff, and that's what we do.
I love that.
The other thing is people can YouTube it, go on YouTube, and you'll see how we invite folks up on the stage, kids who play instruments and sing, and then the whole audience, as much as we can get on the stage, join us to sing I Love It Loud and Do You Love Me, and even Rock and Roll All Night. Anywhere from 60 to 100 people, so that you can video it, send it to your friends, and all that. So, the bottom line is we have a ball.
Yeah, it's an experience. I love that you do that, and I love that you bring whoever wants to come up, musicians, singers, whoever, to experience that with you. I think that's what makes the concerts that you've been doing so unique and
really
so special.
Really talented young folk who, you don't have to bring a guitar. We have extra guitars.
That's great.
You can go on YouTube and plug in 13-year-old drummer joins KISS for nothing to lose. I'm sorry, joins Gene Simmons Band for nothing to lose.
Yeah.
And it'll blow you away. There's a 15-year-old chick guitar player who gets up on stage with us and just blows everybody away. Unbelievable.
That's
the
awesome.
Talent that's out there. Yeah.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And here we are, Gene, 45 years later. I mean, a legacy that has lasted nearly five decades. And, I read one of your books about when you got inspired to do all this and get into music, and it was all about seeing the Beatles on Sullivan for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, that changed my life because, I wasn't born in America, and I always felt like an outsider. And all of a sudden, you see these guys on TV talking like Roth and all. All of a sudden, they didn't sound American.
Yeah,
they sounded like they came from someplace else. And it somehow connected with me, and I felt not so different. Originally in those days, I spoke with an accent. And so I thought, well, this isn't such a bad job. You get to play, have a good time, the chicks like you, and maybe you'll get paid. Maybe I don't have to. Eventually I became a teacher in sixth grade and all kinds of other wacky stuff, but the band thing started right away, and within a year and a half of starting, by 1975, we're playing Anaheim Stadium in California.
It's crazy. The first band was The Missing Links, and then Long Island Sound's Rising Sun. Wicked Lester, really did lay the groundwork for something even bigger. I mean, that was really what moved the needle, I think, right?
Yes, Wicked Lester was the previous band Paul and I had. We actually had a recording contract with Epic Records. And you know what? We just didn't believe it. They say don't look a gift horse in the mouth. That comes from the Trojan War. You can look it up, kids.
Yeah.
And we decided, hindsight's 20/20. We looked at each other and said, you know what? We don't believe in this. And we literally walked out of the band that we started because it just didn't tug at the heartstrings. It just didn't feel authentic. And we decided to put together the band we never saw on stage, a band that didn't have any rules, that didn't try to look or sound like any other band. And here we are today, more gold records than any American band in history, in all categories, I might add.
Yeah.
The Greeks, because I studied Greek philosophy and all that, they said something that actually resonates. To thine own self be true. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
When you're running a race, don't look over your shoulder to see what anybody else is doing. Just do the best you can. Just look straight forward and just run your race.
And I mean, you guys were playing, but you also, you know, you said you were teaching, you know, you did what every aspiring musician did, and you still made a living. You still had a bunch of side jobs at the time that you were doing until you had the opportunity to record a demo tape. And was it at Hendrix Studios? Is that what I read?
Yes, Electric Lady Studios. That's right. We'd done some background vocals for a session. They call it session work, and got a little bit of cash, and instead of taking the cash, got free studio time, and that gave us a chance to do some demos. To make a long story short, you know, there's no journey that you can repeat and figure out. Everybody's got to figure out for themselves. You know, there are a lot of different roads that lead to the top of the mountain, and also, you know, I keep writing books about business and stuff like that. People want it shorthand. They say, what are the 10 rules of success? There are none.
No, it's hard work.
There are no rules to success. You can share the, you know, the age-old adage, which is the harder I work, the luckier I get. And that's about all you get. The rest of it is just having the right thing at the right place at the right time and a lot of work.
A lot of work, yeah. Yeah, there is no good guy. But you are an entrepreneur. I mean, really, in everything that you've done in music and movies and restaurants and all kinds of stuff. I mean, this is really who you are. And I think that's how your brain has always worked. As you said, you know, you didn't take the money. You took the next step
You got to think about the idea. The money will take care of itself, but you got to think of the big idea and then make it work.
Yeah.
I mean, as I'm talking to you, this month in 1,000 7-Eleven stores in Southern California, my sodas called Moneybag Sodas debut. They will soon ramp up to 10,000 stores, and then I intend to take them around the world to 66,000 stores. But that also includes Rock World, my trademarked business model that's going to bring T-shirts and hats into 7-Elevens. They've never sold that stuff before. So there's a lot of exciting stuff going on. But at the end of the day, I've met people who can't sleep at night. My advice is always work harder during the day. I mean, if you're exhausted, you won't have any problem going to sleep.
That's very true. I like that. That's very true. That's very true. And you guys did that, just that. You know, you're mentioning, you know, you were signed by a record label. You signed by Epic, then you were dropped by Epic, and you were determined to make this album. And as you said, you know, you didn't see the band on stage that you wanted to see, and you really had a new vision. You and Paul Stanley really had a new vision for really what you wanted to do, to bring music and theater really to the stage.
Yeah, but you know, it really stemmed from seeing the bands that I loved hearing on the radio. The Love and Spoonful, and the, you know, and everybody, and when you go to see them live, you're looking around going, really? That's it? I mean, there was even a guy named Donovan who put out some decent records that I liked. He used to sit cross-legged on a Persian carpet with incense, bare feet, strumming an acoustic guitar, and I'm thinking, I'm paying full ticket price for that? That's where the term "get out of here" comes from.
Yeah.
Get out of here.
Yeah, get out
and
of
so
here.
So we always wanted to give everybody more. So if you just think to yourself for a second, Paul McCartney, one of the finest of the finest, and Garth Brooks, and even wrestlers, all of that stuff. When you see fireworks going on, where do you think that came from? Men Without Hats? That's an obscure band from Canada.
No, I know. From the 80s, yes. Yeah, that's awesome. And, you know, releasing Alive, did you know that was going to be the album when you guys put that together, that was going to be the album?
No, we didn't know anything. In those days, nobody released live records until your career was over.
Right, that's right.
And you certainly didn't release a double album before you had your first gold album. But we've always thrown caution to the wind, as the saying goes, and dove into the deep end of the pool and just go for it. You know, you're going to have one chance in life. Go for it. If you're going to lose, lose gloriously.
That's right. But that's how you learn, too.
What doesn't kill you.
Yeah, it makes you stronger. You're absolutely right. How'd you deal with the fame and continue really to deal with the fame? Because, you know, you've never... you know, a lot of musicians, and we know this story, a lot of musicians got into booze or got into drugs. It's not something that was ever crossing your path. But what have you done to stay relatively, you know, grounded in all of this back then and now?
Well, I have a secret weapon, and it's my mother, who had a horrible childhood. She grew up during World War II, and actually, when she was 14, she was in the concentration camps of Nazi Germany. And the wisdom that she gave me as a child continues today. You know, I mean, if you only have 24 hours of life on Earth, what are you going to do? You're going to watch Pokemon reruns, or you're going to get out there and
live life.
Yeah, live it. Eat good, love good, work hard, and then you die. Because, by the way, we're all going to get our turn. But while you're alive, I mean, roll up your sleeves and go for it.
Yeah, that's what I think keeps people going. You got to keep doing what you love, right?
And when you stop, your body starts to die.
Yeah.
When water stops moving, it starts to get stale and disease-ridden. It's only if your heart keeps pumping, you'll stay alive and you'll be healthy. You'll sleep good. As soon as you sit around, you'll start to get fat and you will die.
I think you're right. Well, and you've done exactly that. I mean, you've found new ways and new interests over your lifetime just to keep your brain going a little bit. And I love what you just put out, The Vault, you know, kind of looking back a little bit. But I mean, this is the box set of box sets for anybody who loves any band. There's nothing like this box set. It's called The Vault. What made you, you know, really dig deep and pull all that together? Because, I mean, this spans 50 years.
I've been planning it for 10 years. I'm an only child, so I've had a lot of time to think for myself. And I collected me, you know, Star Wars fans and Marvel Comics fans. I'm a Gene Simmons fan. I know it sounds like, what? But so I've saved everything.
Yeah.
And along the years, through the years, I've always written tunes. But very few of them wound up on Kiss records because many of them, well, you know, we've always had more songs that we needed, for one thing. And the other thing is I tried different forms of music, R&B, soul, even semi-country stuff that sounded Eagle-ish, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I always wanted to play the drums and the bass and the guitar and sing all the backgrounds, kind of what McCartney did. So it was a creative outlet for me. And the GeneSimmonsVault.com box set is literally the largest, most comprehensive box set ever released.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to wait until I'm dead for somebody to release something called Posthumous. It means he's dead.
Yeah.
But here we found some lost tracks. I want to be here. Why would you throw a party and not be in it?
Yeah, I love that. That's so true. That's so true. And this box set, I mean, it does that. And the fact that you got to control it, too, I mean, that's another thing. You're right. When
people have no idea that it's literally over 3 feet tall, weighs 40 pounds, got metal hardware and stuff. And inside, over the last music that's, 50 years old, all the way to 2016,
yeah,
along the way I've co-written songs with Bob Dylan, three of them that are on the box set, the Van Halen brothers and I in 1978 came up for three tracks. Joe Perry,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is on a track. All the Kiss guys. Paul and John and Ringo, and see what I did there? See, that was a joke.
Mm-hmm, I like that.
Yeah. So everybody's on the record, and it's a chance for me to kind of, why would you want to leave anything in the attic? You know, there are a lot of houses where they take the blanket out and put it on the lawn, and they stick all this stuff that they've had stored up in the attic. Well, it's kind of the idea. If you leave it up in the attic, nobody will get to see it, and you have a chance to share some of the fun.
We are talking to Gene Simmons from Kiss, and there's more when we come back on 720 WGN.
say I want to set you free. Don't you know you'll be a misery? They call me
Dr. Love.
They call me Dr. Love.
They call me Dr. Love.
I've got the cure, you're thinking of.
Call me Dr. Love.
And even though I'm full of sin, you need my love, and don't you know it's true? So have to please get on your knees. There are no bills, there are no fees. Baby, I know what your problem is. The first step of the cure is a kiss. So call me
Dr. Love.
They call me Dr. Love.
They call me Dr. Love.
I am your doctor of love.
What was it like, Gene, looking back at or listening to some of these songs, even from five decades ago? I mean, did it surprise you on how good some of these songs were and bring in, like, a new appreciation for some of it?
Yeah, I liked a lot of it because during the time we all get trapped by what we're supposed to do. And if you take a step back, you know, because if you're a metal fan, it's supposed to be metal. If you're a pop fan and something's too heavy, well, that's too heavy. And if you step outside of the genre thing and just look at it as pure songwriting, I was surprised by some of it, which I had some I haven't heard for 30 or 40 years. And you get fresh ears, so you get a chance for some perspective. I was quite impressed with it, actually.
That's cool. Yeah, that's cool. The Vault is so much about your songwriting. Who were the songwriters that had the biggest influence on you?
Well, outside of, Tin Pan Alley, Gershwin, people like that, Irving Berlin, who was a little Jewish guy who came from Germany, who couldn't speak English very well, but had a musical mind, little short guy, and changed his name to Berlin, which is where he came from, because people couldn't pronounce his last name. This guy goes to the Beverly Hills Hotel and writes White Christmas. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas.
Yeah.
And Charlie Chaplin, you know, the clown and the movie star, he wrote Smile. Smile, though your heart is aching. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
So when you take a look at, I don't know if it's a miracle or some blessing, whatever, but songs just sort of appear. One second they're not there, then all of a sudden they become real. It's really like magic. I don't know how else to describe it. And when I was a kid, I used to think, oh, surely every song that's possible has been written. But no.
I don't think so.
Yeah. I even have a master class where I teach people how to pick up an instrument, any instrument, simple chords, and you can make up your own melody and your own lyrics.
Yeah, I think it's cool that that you know people, I think, would expect you to say, you know, more rock and roll, you know, from the rock and roll genre from the 50s or the 60s, but it was pretty diverse, your influences. That's pretty cool.
Well, you know, you think of the Beatles and you think Chuck Berry and Motown, but sure enough, on the first record they had A Taste of Honey, A Taste Sweeter Than Wine, and they also did Stephen Sondheim, and, you know, kind of like Broadway musical stuff.
It's true.
There are no rules. If you wind up just being, you know, somebody who follows the rules, you're a lemming.
Yeah.
The idea of rock and roll first started out is there are no rules. You didn't even have to learn how to read or write music. You just make it happen. Just sort of stream of consciousness.
When you sit down and write a song, what is different from when you did it decades ago to today? Because you're still writing.
Actually, Ace called me a short time ago, and he wanted to know if I had any ideas because he's doing another solo record, and I had two that I started working on. One is Your Wish Is My Command, and the other one is Without You, I'm Nothing. And both tracks turned out well, actually, and Ace is going to use them in his new solo record. But how or when these ideas come from, I have no idea. You sit down, and if people who write books
put in the time. Don't wait for inspiration to hit you. Just shut the phones off, which sounds like a curse, right? Shut the phones off. Sit in front of your whatever it is you're doing, if you're a painter, a writer, a creator of something, and put in the time. Go to work, even if you're not inspired. And things happen. Some good, some bad, but you got to put in the time.
Yep, you got to figure it out. You've seen a lot of changes in the music industry. You've said, and I know you've said this, and I've heard this from other rock legends, that rock and roll is essentially dead, or at least the impact of rock and the bands.
It's dead, all right. Yeah. And the only ones to blame are the fans who stopped paying for the music.
Yeah.
So now new bands today, my heart goes out to them. I mean, it breaks my heart to say that if you're a new band, you're just not going to be able to take the time. You're not going to be able to take the time to to devote to your stuff because, hey, people are downloading it for free.
That's true.
So, look, from 1958 until 1988, you had the Beatles and Elvis, and Motown and Madonna and Prince and Bowie, Metallica and on and on and on. From 1988 until today, that's another 30 years, who's the new Beatles?
Yeah. Yeah, you really can't nail it down. It's a little too poppy.
Well, you can't name one.
No.
Even Foo Fighters is an old band. They've been around over 20 years.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely true. Before I let you go, I know you're busy working on a book. You've got this new book imprint, Simmons Books, and you're going to be releasing something, 27, The Legend and the Mythology of the 27 Club, exploring how people from different walks of life, including Jimi Hendrix and Jim Morrison, Kurt Cobain, Amy Winehouse, all died at the age of 27. Tell me a little bit about that.
I mean, even Avicii, this talented guy who's part of the EDM movement, electronic music, just turned 28 and died.
Yeah.
Very bizarre. Going all the way back to the 1800s, the Elephant Man died when he was 27.
Wow.
Something very strange going on, and the book delves into that.
Wow, very cool. And with all the other things
Hendrix, Jim Morrison, Janis Joplin, Mama Cat, Kurt Cobain, Amy Winehouse, you just go on and on and on. If they're going to die, why 27?
Yeah. Yeah, very interesting to look into that. Looking forward to reading that as well. And with all the things you have going on, Gene, is the stage where you enjoy being most?
Where do I enjoy being most?
Yeah, is the stage?
Wherever I am.
But the stage has got to still be one of your first loves.
Well, sure, you get, but they're all different pleasures. Being on the stage doesn't equal anything. And then seeing our kids growing up, that's totally different than the stage, and having the Gene Simmons Band and the Rock and Blues Restaurant chain and the book company and the comic book company, they're all different pleasures. And you literally don't have enough time for me to run through my other stuff.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, the stage is where you're going to be on Thursday, May 3rd at the Arcata Theater. For tickets, visit ArcataLive.com. For more on the Vault box set, you can visit GeneSimmons.com. And if you can't get enough of rock legends Kiss, you can visit KissOnline.com. Gene, a thrill talking to you. Thanks for taking the time and looking forward to seeing you in Chicago, pal.
Thank you, boss.
Thank you. All right, it's 720 WGN.
A place, a pointless thing, devoid of grace, where you don't know what you're after, or if something's after you, and you don't know why you don't know you're alone without heroes. In a world without dreams.
You know why God made snakes before he made lawyers? He needed the practice.
That's pretty much the only lawyer joke I know, because all the others are true stories.
All right, it's Dave Plyer back with you on 720 WGN. So the new season of AMC's Better Call Saul came back with a roar during its four-season premiere a couple weeks ago, and Bob Odenkirk has been writing and performing on both the big and small screen for over 30 years. From Saturday Night Live to Mr. Show and the Larry Sanders Show to Breaking Bad, Bob Odenkirk has seen and done it all. And like millions, I'm a big fan of Better Call Saul, and I'm thrilled to say Bob Odenkirk joins us tonight. Bob, nice to have you with us and hear from your hometown.
Very good to talk to you. I wish I was there right now, but I'm in L.A. where I live.
I gotcha. I gotcha. Well, I got to tell you, loved your work. I mean, really from the very beginning, the Ben Stiller Show, Mr. Show, Larry Sanders. Loved every single character you developed in every show, every movie. Saul Goodman, Jimmy, is as corrupt and as nasty as they come. How did you actually make this character likable?
Well, I give a lot of credit to the writers because they wrote a spirited fellow who is very entertaining to watch. He says a lot of funny things, and frankly, he's very often he's entertaining himself. He's smiling at his own antics.
Yeah,
and I think people are audiences. It's kind of infectious, his joy at what he's doing. And even though he's very often being duplicitous or using someone or in some way doing something like a con, which can, you know, which is ethically questionable, he's having so much fun doing it, and he's so inspired at his plans that it's very hard not to like a person who's trying to win, even if they're trying to win in a deceitful manner.
Well, I don't even want to say it's like watching a car crash, because you know you want to see what's going on and what's happening. You know what he's doing is kind of devious, but it just makes you, I think, want more, right?
It is so. He's a car crash. He's a human. he's a human accident that is happening, and he's running down the road, smashing into things, and we're all sitting back and enjoying it.
Yeah.
But the really, truly, the moments where he's truly a bad guy, I think, are the moments where you can see him have an option to do something right or be a more human person, and he makes the choice to manipulate or hurt someone. And those don't come all the time, you know. Those are come along once in a while. The episode 2 that just played has a moment in it that it's very unjustified from what you can tell, except if you know the character and if you know where he's going. But otherwise, there's no justification for the way he turns on those two guys who run the copier company and give him a job, offer him a job, and then he turns and tells them they were clowns to believe what he had to say.
Well, and spoiler alert, if you haven't seen the first couple of episodes, Michael McKean's character, who played your brother Chuck, has passed on. Although we might continue to see him, what did you think when you learned that the character of Chuck was going to die?
Well, I love working with Michael McKean because he's one of the great actors of our time, and he's done some of the greatest projects in comedy and in drama. He's just a powerhouse performer and a wonderful person as well. So I knew I'd miss him mostly just on the set. But I do think that, like a lot of the fans, and I do watch the show as a fan of Breaking Bad myself.
That's cool. That's cool.
I want to see, even though I don't want it to go too fast, I do want to get there. I want to get to the Breaking Bad world. I'm eager to see this thing explode more. And so even though we had to lose Chuck and Michael's talents because of that, I do like the movement forward. I like when the plot lurches forward, which it tends to do. It kind of seems to be taking its time, and there's a lot of building blocks that get set up, and then all of a sudden it makes a little lurches forward, and so I like that.
I can tell already that Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad, the relevance of that connection will be a little bit more obvious this season.
Yeah. I actually feel like when this season is a little over halfway done, there's going to be a feeling among Breaking Bad fans who know the show that you haven't really seen Breaking Bad unless you've watched Better Call Saul too.
Right.
Because that's how much of the story is starting to overlap, and in fact, I can't spoiler the season ahead.
Right.
In this season, there's scenes that are essentially you could almost call them part of the Breaking Bad storyline.
Yeah. Well, and what I can tell, your character is in a tough place as he's now living with his brother telling him that he never mattered to him. He's got to live that down every single day. I also feel like we're going to get a little darker this season.
Yeah, I mean, Jimmy is becoming this Saul character who you met right. in Breaking Bad, and right. Saul is an ethically, he has no grounding at all. Nothing is holding him down. He is a free radical, moving around yeah. and just tearing apart things. And it gets his soul gets darker. He was a good guy.
Yes.
It was amazing what a good yeah. person they invented Saul out of. He was a very likable Chicagoan from Cicero, good Catholic boy,
right?
who had some bad. He had some instincts that went the wrong way, and he had some talents that were easily manipulated into the wrong, unethical, plots and plans. But he was a good guy, and he's becoming a not good guy.
All right, we're talking to Chicago's very own Bob Odenkirk on the new season of AMC's Better Call Saul. And there's more when we come back on 720 WGN.
Tonight, the elderly. Good evening and welcome to the pre-taped call-in show where we tape all our shows a week in advance. I'm your host, Ken Doral, and let's try it again. It's really not that hard, okay? Our topic, once again, is the elderly. Okay, we're taping it now, and it airs next week, okay? So, if you're watching me talk about the elderly, don't call to talk about it. It's too late. Instead, call about cooking, which is next week's topic, okay? If you wanted to talk about the elderly, you should have called last week when our pet care show was airing, but we were taping the elderly show. Okay, so here we go. Hello.
Hi, Ken. Great show.
Thank you. What can I do for you?
My dog has a disobedience problem.
Okay,
and,
okay. There you go. Okay, that's boo-boo number one. Hopefully that'll be our last. Okay, look, if you wanted to talk about pet care, you should have called 2 weeks ago when our show on racism was airing. Okay, I'm doing a show about the elderly right now, which, of course, to you people watching means call in about cooking. Okay, we'll see if we... Hello.
Yeah, hi. What's going on? I mean, you're doing a show about pet care, but everybody's talking about racism.
No,
I don't...
no, okay, no. No, I'm not doing a show about pet care. I'm doing a show about the elderly. The people calling about racism are watching the show that aired when we were taping the pet show, which is airing now. Okay? If they wanted to talk about racism, they should have called 3 weeks ago when our Crime in the Street show aired. Okay? It's just, let's think before we...
Day player on 720 WGN. We're talking to Chicago's very own Bob Odenkirk on the new season of AMC's Better Call Saul. Some of the funny comes from your time in Chicago at Southern Illinois University. Sketch writing and performing came into play in college, but you were writing sketches in elementary school, weren't you?
Yeah, well, mostly I started in junior high at Jefferson Junior High School in Naperville.
Yeah.
And I had a couple teachers there who... encouraged me to write sketch comedy pieces that were informational as part of my projects in, I believe that was seventh grade.
Okay.
And that was really the start for me. Those teachers, I think I wrote four or five sketches over the course of a year, and we performed them for the classes. Got a lot of good laughs.
Yeah.
And got some great grades and got a lot of encouragement from the teachers for that. There's no doubt that that was an important thing for me that made me feel like this was a skill I might have. It still took a long time for me. When you live in Chicago, when you live in Naperville, and you live in the outskirts of a bigger city, you know, the idea of show business is so far away from yeah. where you live.
And sure.
It took me a long, long time to just imagine that I could actually, that it was legitimate for me to try.
Well, and even being in the burbs, I mean, you listened to Chicago radio growing up here. Who were some of your influences? Who were some of the guys you listened to growing up?
Well, look, Steve Dahl is absolutely number one influence for me. If you're talking Chicago radio,
sure.
I think I related to his anarchic sense of humor, his cynicism, and his sarcasm, which Steve is from California, but he's right. got a very Chicago, I mean, there's a reason he's been on the air in Chicago for most of his career.
Oh, no, he's got a Chicago way about him.
Yeah, there's a very Chicago point of view on the world, which is, you know, skeptical and very down to earth. And maybe even at times a little mean, but always to good ends.
Yeah, I agree.
To make you laugh.
Yeah.
And to tear down the people who are full of themselves.
Oh man, we had so many radio greats here in Chicago as well. But Bozo, what about Bozo? I can't ask a question on a station with the letters WGN without Bob Bell.
Bob Bell, who played Bozo when I was a kid, and even through my teen years. He was one of the most naturally funny. I put him next to Bill Murray as like funniest Chicagoan ever.
Yeah,
and I mean they're both naturally, easily, without trying, so likably funny. And yeah, I mean that's just to be envied and treasured. The point of view of Bob Bell and that voice he had, and the same of. I love Bill Murray.
Yeah.
He's just the best.
I've heard you do a little Bob Bell voice before. You're damn close, man. It's almost like he's right there.
Hey, Cookie, it was a little bit like a drunk guy, a little bit. A guy with a stuffed up nose. yeah.
It is true. But, you know, what was cool is he was entertaining kids, but he was entertaining every adult in that room and on the air as well, right?
Listen, any adult watching, without being remotely scatological, remotely crude,
yeah.
he was, you were just, it was his point of view.
Yeah.
And it was his good-natured, you know, kind of ironic stance. He was a genius. And I sure wish he'd done some, you know, sketch comedy or any kind of adult kind of performance or yeah. comedy. I don't know what his story was. I'll always be curious about what kind of guy he actually was and what he aspired to in life, because from my point of view, he could have been anything. He could have yeah. been a movie star and you know, you never know with the Chicagoan whether, you know, sometimes people make the choice to just go, yeah, that's okay. I like living in Chicago and I like
yeah.
being around my kids and raising my family and being a dad, and I don't need to spend my whole life or give over my whole life to some career. And I really I love Bob Bell, and he, if only I could be touched by some of the natural humor of those great Chicagoans, that would be the gift of all time.
Yeah, and two great ones you mentioned there. And Monty Python was a big influence for you, too.
Yeah, Monty Python on Channel 11. They played it on Channel 11.
Yes,
but also
did.
Channel 11 played. I mean, Python was like my guiding light. Really, it was. I mean, the smartness of it, the absurdity of it, the silliness of it. Adults doing material that was that silly was like spoke to my heart and made me happy in a deep, deep way. But also Channel 11played other British shows
yeah,
that
did.
Influenced me, like The Goodies.
Yep.
And Dave Allen at Large.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. And I don't know who played Marty Feldman's Comedy Machine. I think that was on Network. But that was some of the Python guys helped with that, I believe. And so that British comedy that came through Channel 11 really got into my head. The Two Ronnies, watched The Two Ronnies when I was young, and they played it there on Channel 11. So, you know, that really got into my head and helped me develop the voice that I had in comedy.
So you have all that and all that influence that you grew up with. Then you're at Second City. You're studying, yeah. You're studying with Del Close. You meet Robert Smigel there. Then you start writing for Saturday Night Live. I mean, this is the pattern. Yeah. The journey of your career is always amazing to me.
It's a weird journey. You know, before all that, you know, Second City, the whole scene in Chicago was different than it is now. There were far fewer classes, and Second City really only had these, they weren't very structured classes. So I actually took classes at a place called the Players Workshop of Second City, which had a more structured program that took about a year and a half to complete and felt like it really got you somewhere. And I met Robert Smigel there. But I also did comedy at Southern Illinois University with my friend Tim Thomas. I did a show called The Primetime Special, and we had a lot of fun. I did a show that was kind of like Mr. Show, which I later did on HBO, which kind of a semi-themed sketch show.
I love that show. Brilliant. Nothing short of brilliant.
Well, thank you. Well, thanks. I had such freedom at Mr. Show. HBO let us do whatever we wanted. And they actually truly didn't care if anybody watched, as long as people felt they should watch.
Yeah.
As long as it created a ruckus.
Well, think about
as
this.
As long as it made people... Yeah.
No, I'm sorry. Well, think about this, though. When the show went on the air, compared to today, you know, you said there was limited places to do a lot of this stuff. There was limited networks or that would even air something like this. That was groundbreaking in and of itself, being on HBO.
Oh, absolutely. There were not many alternate places to do a show, to do an original show. We were very lucky, the right executives at the right time, and to some extent HBO was not yet successful. And that can be a very good thing, because until they had The Sopranos and Sex and the City, they didn't have sort of success that they were trying to duplicate. There was nothing to duplicate. They didn't have any success. So we came in a corner of the market and got to just do our thing for 4 years.
I was geeking out watching some of the shows. A pre-tape call-in show was probably still my favorite.
Oh, yeah.
Still my favorite.
Yeah, there's some great sketches. I mean, really, the thing that drove me in writing and creating that show was great sketch work. I love Bob and Ray. And, of course, Python, and I loved Peter Cook and Dudley Moore and their work. I just love great sketches. And to me, Mr. Show, when we did it right, we did, number one, we did a couple really great sketches, like the audition, pre-tape call-in show, Young People and Their Companions, The Story of Everest, Lie Detector, The
Commercials of the Future was another great one. Change for a Dollar was another favorite.
Yeah. A lot of really just solid sketches with great ideas, well executed, beginning, middle, and end, and kind of not leaning too much on the moment. Just you could do them now and you'd get the same laughs. You know, you'd get just as good a reaction from an audience. I think the Burgundy Loaf is a great one. the restaurant that's so fancy that it doesn't have toilets. It is just
it's classic. No, it's classic. But now here you are in HBO, and they're kind of giving you the freedom to do what you want. Did you ever, you know, when you sat down with David Cross, did you ever have an argument over a sketch in the writer's room about the content or the joke or the sketch itself? I mean, or did everything kind of flow its way?
We often did. No, we often... The arguments were this. HBO gave us total freedom. They asked us to cut one line, which is so awful and crude that I can't even say it to you on the radio.
I know what it is.
Because you'd have to bleep it out.
Yeah.
It was... you know, but we liked being provocative and edgy.
Yeah.
But we always asked ourselves, who are we actually making fun of with this sketch? So if we were playing somebody who was mentally dim, we would ask ourselves, yeah, but we don't want to actually make fun of people who have mental issues. Mm-hmm. That's not funny, and it's not okay. So are we sure that, because we don't want to do that. So, and oftentimes, you know, when you do comedy, you do stuff that you talk about sex, maybe, or you talk about challenging things that provoke people that already get them sitting on the edge of their seat, which can turn into a laugh if you break it the right way, if you turn it the right way. But you have to ask yourself, who's being torn down with this? And make sure it's somebody or something that maybe deserves it and not somebody who doesn't deserve it. And then we did a lot of stuff that was kind of provocative, but boy, I don't know. It wasn't really critical of anything. It was just pointing out, I think, that people are pretty strange creatures. I mean, we did the black Ku Klux Klan leader in our first season, and it's really funny. You know, he's talking about it's the new KKK, and it's not about race anymore, and it's about all these hobbies. You can't help but laugh at how stupid and silly it is, but you also kind of go, why is this funny? What is this about? You know, I mean, and you can't really put your finger on it. It's just fun to take something and turn it that way. And at the same time, there's something that almost makes you go, wow, I actually think that could happen.
Well, and we're so worried about political correctness these days. We just need to laugh and do and watch. This is the type of stuff that we need, I think, just to make people laugh. Yeah. This is it's all a joke. It's all for fun. And I think we've lost a little of that.
I think the one thing that irks me is if the piece that is upsetting you is advertised as comedy, is clearly set up as comedy, if it takes place in a comedy club, if it's in a comedy theatrical show, if a stand-up comedian is doing it on stage, then you have to recognize that everyone has, there's a basic agreement that this is not meant except as a provoker of laughter. And if it doesn't make you laugh, well, then they failed.
Yeah, right.
But it's not a polemic. It's not a person lecturing you.
Yeah.
The difficult part is when you get into things like Twitter, I think, really kind of people did things on Twitter before they figured out what Twitter meant to everyone else. They for some people they said, oh, I see, it's a platform for my jokes, and that had not been established yet. And in the end, that's not what Twitter is. But I think a lot of comedians in particular thought, oh, what a perfect, it's just a stage for my comedy jokes,
right?
But the thing is that isn't what had been established yet about what Twitter was. And so I think now we're finally, after all these years, getting closer to what Twitter is to other people. And that's what defines it, you know. But at the same time, I don't think it's fair to have a person go in a comedy club and see a comedian, and the comedian does provocative material, and then walk out and treat it like they went and saw a political speech.
Yeah, then their intention walking in there wasn't right. Yeah, then their intention walking in there wasn't right. Yeah. If you weren't going there to laugh, then you're in the wrong place.
Right, right. And you cannot laugh. That's for sure. That's up to you. Yeah. And if a comedian is not making people laugh, then he's failing. So if he's doing all kinds of rude, crude stuff and saying nasty things and you're not laughing, well, he's the loser in that interchange.
Absolutely.
But you can't take what's said in there and walk out and go, this person believes that, they spoke to me about it, they said that's what they believed. Comedy is a way of being honest, but it's a roundabout way of being honest. And if you really want to tell people what you think, well, go ahead and write an essay and put it in the paper. And,
sure.
And there's a million places for that as well.
Different forum.
Yeah.
Different forum.
Yeah. So anyway, I think it's been hard for everyone in the audience sometimes to figure out, and we have these like entirely new platforms, and we just haven't sorted out yet what we're doing on them yet. What we're all agreed is happening there.
Sure.
Yeah. So.
I hear comedians and writers and actors say all the time how much Mr. Show was an influence on their careers. I think that's pretty cool.
Well, I think it's super cool. I'm very proud of influencing people, and I hope that what they took from it is that we really cared about doing it well, doing the mechanics of the sketch right, more than we cared about fame or anything. We were like nerdy sketch writers. That's what we were, and to a weird extent.
Yeah.
But I think it's one of the reasons we inspired a lot of people. And then I think people like Key and Peele took what we did, and they made it more popular than we made it, because they're just, I mean, in particular, Keegan-Michael Key is one of the most likable human beings walking the planet. Him and Tom Hanks, and you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's just, yeah.
That guy is just incredibly... You can't help but smile and like anything he's doing.
sure, no, absolutely.
So, but I'm proud of influencing people and the sketches that we did. And with Bob and David, the reunion show we did at Netflix was a lot of fun, too.
So your nephews, Keenan and Tristan, are in the business, and you gave them some advice, and you said, unless you have a passion for this that is so overpowering for you personally, if you can do anything else and be happy, do the other thing. But they say you're an inspiration to him, to both of them. I think it's pretty cool that they're kind of following in their uncle's footsteps here.
Well, I hope my brother doesn't mind, because he went out to Arizona, but even further away in its own way from Hollywood, and certainly further away from Second City.
Yeah.
And he's a banker, my brother Steve, and a good, good man and a great, great father. And then these two boys decide, no, we want to be like our uncle.
I think that's so awesome. Yeah,
it's funny, but they're great actors. Those guys are Shakespearean trained actors, and I am not. I am not. I have never done Shakespeare. I have only made fun of Shakespeare.
Yeah, right. That's awesome. Well, I'll tell you what, the new season of Better Call Saul is underway, and you can catch brand new episodes every Monday night at 8 Central on AMC. Bob, what a thrill chatting with you, not only about Better Call Saul, but Mr. Show and your career in Chicago and all that good stuff. And next time you're in town, love for you to stop by in studio and hang out with us.
Very good. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Bob. All right. Much more ahead on 720 WGN.
WLS Boogie Jack.
Hi, Dan.
Hi there.
I have a joke for you, and it is not about Farrah Fawcett. Got it?
Well, I don't know if I want to hear it.
Well, it's good. It's not about Farrah Fawcett, and you're sick of hearing those, right?
Give me a little more phone. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
Ah, there. Yeah?
I haven't started yet.
Oh, no, I wasn't agreeing with you.
Oh, okay.
All right.
What kind of people cannot be put in jail?
Innocent people.
Besides them.
Besides them?
Yeah.
How complicated is this going to get?
It's not complicated. Besides innocent people.
That thou mayest bear thine own shame and mayest be confounded in all that thou hast done.
In 10 years, when someone says, "Hey, I've got a trivia question for you," what were the first words Bob Sirott ever said in mono on WLS? Just tell him, "This is one small record for man, but one giant leap for Bob Sirott."
Hello, everybody. Dick Leonti with you on the Big KB. Going to be with you until midnight over 17 states in the Eastern Seaboard and everybody up there in Canada. Good to have you aboard. You'll never believe what happened to me this morning. My boss got on me again, called me in, and he said, "Dick,
you talk too much. You worry me to death. You talk too much. You even worry my pet. You just talk too much."
All right, Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. Two, count them, two radio legends join us tonight. One began his radio career in high school and debuted on WLS in 72, and the other started as an NBC page in 1966. We're talking about John Records Landecker and Bob Surratt. Then there's another radio icon, Dick Biondi, and there's a new biopic called the Dick Biondi Film, celebrating over 70 years on the year, which includes John and Bob. Dick is 85, doing well, and there's a screening scheduled on Wednesday, August 8th at the Beverly Arts Center, where John will be making an appearance and hang out and catch up with these radio legends, both John Records Landecker and Bob Surratt. Join us tonight. What's up, gentlemen?
You are.
Due to the length of that introduction, we have no time to chat. So thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
I am known for my long introductions. I can't help it. Hey, John, for you, welcome to the new Allstate Skyline Studios.
Thank you very much. It's very impressive.
Isn't it cool?
How many flights up?
We are 18 flights up.
And you look right into an apartment building.
yes, we do. That's our new...
Hey, that's me. That's me in the apartment. Wait, let me get my pants on.
Put your underpants on. It's the Allstate Peeping Tom Studios.
That's what it is. Yeah, we're going to call that that. I love that.
You know, I want to talk about both of your early days in radio, and I know Dick Biondi was revered by both of you. I'm going to start with John here. You were fascinated by radio as a kid. I mean, that was something you wanted to do right from the beginning.
I don't remember a time, excuse me, when I wasn't interested in radio. Yeah, from elementary school on, really.
At some point, the third radio market in the country came calling, one of the biggest music stations in the country, the Big 89 WLS. How did that all come about?
I was working at WIBG in Philadelphia doing nights from 6 until 10. And the story, as I hear it, is that WLS wanted to hire a new night jock. And WLS was owned by ABC, as was WABC in New York. So this roundabout story goes that the guy in charge at WLS got a hold of the guy at WABC in New York, who had a friend who was the program director of WFIL in Philadelphia. And that was the WIBG competition. And they contacted him. And I guess he mentioned my name. And Mike McCormick, who was the PD at WLS, flew to Philadelphia. I didn't know any of this was going on. Listened to the show, went back to Chicago, and called me as though nothing had happened.
Wow.
You know, we're interested in you. Yeah. Would you like to send a resume, perhaps a tape, that kind of thing? And I did. And that's that.
And here's the crazy thing. They didn't let you use records. Which is truly your middle name.
Well,
you know,
when I first went to WIBG, it was a very strict format, and I was given the name Scott Walker. So obviously, I didn't use it there. Then the station changed ownership, and the new people came in, and they said, "Well, what do you want to be?" And I said, "Well, I want to be John Records Landecker." And they said, "Okay." So I did that, and then I came here, and they said, "We're not going to do that middle name thing." And that lasted until Mike McCormick was let go.
Yeah, gotcha.
And the moment he walked out the building, it was on the air.
So really, for you, John, you know, it was more growing up with CFL than it was even WLS.
Well, in my very, very early years in Ann Arbor, I listened to a couple of local stations that really in Ann Arbor who were rock stations. And one of the guys was a guy named Ally McLaughlin, who went on to be a producer and produced the Capitol's Cool Jerk record. You know that? That's you're too young.
Yeah.
but I know
the song.
Then I listened to Detroit, and that was Joel Sebastian, who had worked in Chicago many times, a guy named Lee Allen. And then I went to college, as I said, in Allendale to Grand Valley State University, and I found WCFL. And WCFL was so awesome. I just thought it was just so fantastic. And everybody on the air had a thing. They had a guy named Barney Pipp. And it wasn't just Barney Pipp, it was Pipp's people. They had Dick Williamson. It was Dick Williamson's world. They had Jim Stagg. It was the Stagg line. And I'm like, this is fantastic. Do I have anything I can use? Why, look at that. Records is my middle name.
Yeah, hello. Hello.
I'll use that.
Yeah, yeah. Or not.
Well, that way, I mean,
yeah.
I looked at my, I don't know what I was looking at, either some form I was filling out for college or something else, and I had to write my middle name down. And I'm like, oh, look at that. Nobody's going to believe it.
Yeah. You were talking about Dick Orkin, too.
Dick Orkin was the production director at WCFL. People in Chicago know this. And then went on to do these fantastic commercials, radio commercials. But he was the originator of Chicken Man and many other things. Chicken Man was a radio production, local radio production project. And that may not mean anything to a lot of people, but the idea that one radio station would take the time to put that kind of thing together and the effort today, you wouldn't find, I'm just saying in my own opinion, that you won't find anything like that.
But Dick was a creative genius. He really was.
And he was the production director of a radio station.
Yeah, and made that all happen for himself. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I love that station. Bob and I were talking about Ron Britton, and you'd have to listen to Ron Britton tapes or air checks or whatever you want to do online to find out what we're
talking
about.
You can't find those. You can find those. Even on YouTube, they're on there.
Uh-huh. I went on this little, I was on this little daytime station in Wyoming, Michigan, WERX, and I thought, I'm going to do a show like Ron Britton. And I went on, I'm in college, and I did all this stuff, and the boss goes, I don't know what you were doing, but if you ever do that again, you're done. So that didn't work out too well.
Yeah. But, I mean, you had your influences and sure, guys that you listened to along the way out of Chicago, but up in Michigan, too.
Oh, everybody does.
Yeah.
That's the way you do it.
You are mine. So is Bob.
Oh, my God.
I'm telling you. And obviously, you know, Bob was there as well. And these were the golden days of radio in Chicago, I think. And the 70s at WLS, I think anyone who grew up in Chicago would say that was the heyday of big-time radio.
Oh, I think Bob would agree to that. You betcha. Yeah. We were like, huge. We were the biggest. We were huge. You understand? Huge.
Well, you know what? There was, and of course, John was there when I got there. But you know, there was nothing else to do. You didn't have the internet. You didn't have DVDs. That was it. And you barely had FM. That was just getting popular. You had you didn't have 1,000 TV channels, so it was a different time.
Well, and Bob, for you, Chicago runs through your blood, and I know we got to know each other a little bit here at WGN, but I've always been a fan. I have a box somewhere of WLS music charts with all your faces.
Oh yeah,
on those. I mean, those were collectible. You couldn't wait every week to go.
There's a lot of those around.
Yeah.
Isn't it funny how for a lot of us, we would go to the record store, pick up that free WLS Music Radio Survey, or in the old days, the Silver Dollar Survey, and you would root for your favorite record to move up the charts like you were going to get a piece of the action or something.
That's true. Oh, no, that's totally true. And you, I mean, Bob, you were, I mean, you're a guy that wanted to get into broadcasting right away, too. You started at NBC as a page. Were you in high school at that time, or was that college for you?
Yeah, I was in my last year in high school, and I got a job on the guest relations staff. NBC page really was kind of all-around, all-purpose gopher at the time, Channel 5 and the radio station at the time, MAQ, both in the merchandise mart. And
that's
so we worked for both stations. We answered phones and went to get newspapers to bring to the newsroom and gave tours, that sort of thing.
Did you know when you were going to Columbia that you wanted to get into radio or television? Like, what did you want to do, like, ultimately?
I think I was always interested in radio and didn't think about TV too much until I was in radio for quite a while. So growing up listening to WLS and later WCFL, that's where I got the bug. And I know for John, WCFL was his station, and we both kind of idolized Ron Britton, who was on at night on the station and really was one of the more creative guys around.
I was going to college at Grand Valley State University in Allendale, Michigan, which is on the western part of the state, and I discovered WCFL. And specifically Ron Britton.
Especially at nighttime, getting a nice clear signal.
And that was my go-to show from then on.
That's wild.
But one thing for people who weren't growing up in Chicago in the 60s and don't really understand the Dick Biondi magic, these days if you get 2, 3, or 4% of an audience share in the ratings, you are one of the more successful people in the country. Yeah. Dick had 56% of the audience.
Isn't that crazy? I know. Yeah.
During his 9 to midnight show on WLS in the early 60s.
But Dick was he at the station when you guys got there, or was Mm-mm. he? No, he was gone by that point.
Well, this is the thing. But yeah. Bob will know this specifically. Yeah. You know, Dick has a great legacy and history and iconic and all of that in Chicago, and at WLS. But I believe the WLS job lasted only 2 or 3 years, is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
I think by 1963, or the end of 63, he was gone. He came back for a while on WCFL in the late 60s, but then He was gone. He was gone from Chicago from, you know, somewhere in the late 60s. He left, and he was gone until he returned in the 80s. And that's kind of where the story of the TV show I did and Dick Biondi comes in. I was at Channel 2 at the time, right, yeah, working for the news department and also doing some specials. And I did a series of specials called Where Are They Now? And for whatever reason, in 82 or 83, and Dick had been gone, as I say, about 15 years or more, and he kind of was, I don't want to say forgotten, but, you know, in the age before the internet, it was hard to follow these people and keep track of them and hear them. And so it took a little bit of detective work to figure out that Dick had moved to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and he was doing a morning show on an FM station there and leading a kind of quiet life, playing golf and working at this small station. So we went down there and did a feature on Dick and what he was doing now, and interviewed him and showed him playing golf and doing his show in Myrtle Beach. And that show, it was a primetime special on Channel 2. They preempted something one summer night for the show. And the show was enormously successful, in large part due to the popularity of Dick Biondi and the fact that we promoted that we would tell you about Dick. And a manager at WBBM-FM at the time hired Dick because of all the commotion that this TV show stirred up, brought Dick back for a morning show on BBM-FM in the 80s. That didn't last that long, but then Dick moved on from there, and he stayed in Chicago through the remainder of the 80s, the 90s, and the 2000s, until he was just, on WLS-FM recently.
I think he and Ron Britton sort of launched Oldies 104.3.
They did, yeah.
Together.
But isn't it wild? Because if you're a Chicagoan, you kind of in your mind think that Dick has been on the radio here nonstop since 1960.
And at WLS for the past 40 years.
You really
right?
do. I mean, it's
yeah, that's right.
No, it's true.
Yeah.
It's true.
And how many people say, I was listening the night he made that joke, and that joke never happened. The one
that
allegedly
right?
got him fired about skirts being too short and the resulting cosmetic applications that would be required after that.
Yeah. I think there were two or three different
scenarios,
different quote dirty jokes,
yeah,
unquote,
yeah,
attributed to him. That,
none of
that
which
never,
happened. None of it happened.
Mentioned.
Never happened.
No, he had a big fight with the sales department, I guess, at the radio station, because he thought there were too many commercials in his show, and Dick ended up, I don't know, throwing a punch or an ashtray or something, whatever, and he was asked to just cool off for a while and leave, and then Dick, being a guy who has a lot of pride, I guess, never really apologized, and eventually just, I don't know if he was fired or quit, but left the station at that time. And I remember as a kid, that was the big news. It was, where's Dick? What happened? And I can almost still remember the night Art Roberts, who took over the show, came on and explained that Dick was no longer there, and it was a big deal for the kids to go through that.
You know, Dick has made a career of reaming management on the air.
Is that
every
right?
Every single job.
That's awesome.
You know, like, the boss is going to do this. The boss did that. I can't stand the boss. What's wrong with the boss? He did it when I was with him at 104.3. He did it at 94.7. I think he's been doing it his entire career. It's part of Dick's thing.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I heard you say, because I saw clips of the film, that Dick was there for everybody. And you kind of said he was in the recording studio when the Stones did Satisfaction with kind of a jealousy that he was there.
I never interpreted that clip to be have any kind of jealousy to it, but you're the second person to mention that word, so I guess it's there. I would take it as admiration and astonishment.
Okay, yeah.
That any disc jockey would be in any studio with a group the stature of the Stones doing one of their biggest hits ever.
That's huge.
Oh, yeah, it's huge.
But I mean, people grew up with, and we talk about Dick that way, but I'm just going to say this to you guys, both of you guys. We grew up with you. I mean, I didn't grow up with Dick. I grew up with John Records Landecker and Bob Sirott on WLS and Larry Lujack and everybody else. The 70s was all about LS. I was born in 67, so that was my time.
You see, Dick is one of the, and maybe the last remaining air personality, rock and roll disc jockey, if you will, who's been there from the very, very beginning. And he met personally and made friends with and had relations with many of the early iconic performers. Anybody from Tony Orlando, the Beach Boys have a story about him when he worked out at KRLA and playing Elvis. One of their songs. It just goes on and on.
Yeah, he actually was on stage at the Hollywood Bowl and out in California introducing the Beatles out there. Yeah. And he also, years before that, was at an event where he was on stage with Elvis. So not too many guys have that history with them.
Well, Bob, you clearly said, and you raised Biondi to the title of the American rock and roll disc jockey. I mean, that's really who he is.
Yeah, well, I've said this before, that Dick, you know, until very recently here, was still in the game. He was still on the air. He was still very active. Yeah. And I think had Dick not been, you know, there would have been a movie about him years ago. There would have been statues about him. A few years ago, I got involved in with Alderman Brendan Riley, and we had a street dedicated to him. It was actually supposed to be sort of, you know, right next to the stone container building, what was then the stone container at 360 North Michigan, where Dick did his legendary shows. But something happened. There was a paperwork error in the streets a few blocks away, but it's kind of near the alley where you can see the studio window there.
That's cool.
And, but Dick would have many more accolades. He's in all the halls of fame, but because he's still been active and he's still been around until just recently, you know, there hasn't been a lot of to-do about him.
And he's not a self-promoter.
No.
I don't know how many times I said to him, you know, you really ought to write a book. Nobody cares about what I did.
Oh, my God.
Seriously. Many times over the years.
You know what? And I can even remember way back when we did that TV show in Myrtle Beach, and you know he knew we were coming, and then when we showed up, he sort of looked at us and said, "Really? Do you want to do this? I don't know." You know, he's a very mercurial figure, and he's always been. He's felt this way too about this film. He's kind of embarrassed by all of that. What he loves is to just be on the radio and. Maybe as much as that, meet people, meet his listeners, go out to personal appearances. Yep. You know, he's even as recently as a couple of years ago when he'd be out at a reunion or something.
A car dealership.
So many people.
You know, many car dealerships in the Chicago area have had Dick Biondi as a host for a remote.
Yeah, and he was always like that. Taking time before or after a show to talk on the phone or meet people, meet kids who would come to the studio. He just loved it. And then I think what's coming around now and this film is a result of a fan who was on the receiving end of some of that niceness from Dick Biondi back in the day. And it's coming around now, coming back to Dick.
When I was at 94.7 and Dick came over to work at 94.7, actually he was there first, I'd go in and Dick would follow me on the air. And as soon as he would get on the air, the private line in the studio would start ringing. And it was from people he had been giving the private line to for probably 25, 30, 40 years. They weren't necessarily listeners anymore, but they knew that they could call this number at that time and talk to Dick.
Talk to him.
Every night,
that
private line started ringing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Off air,
absolutely. Wow.
Well, what happened back in the early 60s when Dick was first on LS is he was on 9 to Midnight, and everybody, kind of word got out that he would get into the station at about 7:30 or so, and kids would call the number to talk to Dick, and Dick would just take one call after another, and you know, take your name down if you wanted a dedication, or he'd say hi to you, and it was hard to get through, but he did it all the time, and kids would, you know, call and, you know, get the busy signal and keep trying to get Dick, and that led to a cultural phenomenon of the day called the beep line, which was very interesting. And what the beep line was the phone lines or circuits or whatever, it was so overloaded with everybody calling the same number to talk to Dick between about 7:30 and 9 p.m. that kids started hearing other kids between the beeps of the busy signal. And, wow. You know, boys met girls, girls met boys. It was written about, and eventually, you know, the phone company did something about it. But the beep line was kind of the first sort of online dating.
That's awesome.
Not online dating man. System.
Not to boast.
Not exactly online, on phone line.
Not to boast and brag, but I guess I will. I've been told by people that the same thing happened when Boogie Check was on.
Oh,
in the 70s,
sure.
That lines really? Overloaded, and people were talking to each other when they weren't on the air.
Hi, Eric Stratton, Rush Chairman. Damn glad to meet you.
Hi, that was Eric Stratton, Rush Chairman. He was damn glad to meet you.
Just a minute. Just settle down. This is Ken Dorfman. He's a legacy from Harrisburg.
Okay, this guy is a real zero, that's true. Let's just think back to when you guys were freshmen, huh? Boone, you had a face like a pepperoni pizza, right? And Stork here. Everybody thought the Stork was brain damaged. I myself was so obnoxious, the seniors used to beat me up once a week. So this guy is a total loser? Well, let me tell you the story of another loser.
You gentlemen seen your midterm grades yet?
Oh, they're not posted yet, sir.
I've seen them. Mr. Kroger, 2 C's, 2 D's, and an F. That's a 1.2 grade average. Congratulations, Kroger. You're at the top of the Delta Pledge class. Mr. Dorfman.
Hello.
0.2. Fat, drunk, and stupid is no way to go through life, sir.
Day player on 720 WGN. So the late legendary Harold Ramis changed comedy at the movies with groundbreakingly funny films like Caddyshack, Ghostbusters, Groundhog Day, National Lampoon's Vacation, and of course National Lampoon's Animal House, which is celebrating its 40th anniversary this Saturday on July 28th. It starred John Belushi and our guest tonight, Tim Matheson, who starred in well over 100 movies and TV series over the years, including most recently on CBS's The Good Fight. And he joins us tonight. Welcome in, Tim.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Congrats on 40 years. What were you, like 10 years old when you did this film?
Yeah, right. And it was my first comedy, though.
Yeah, it was. But before I jump into that, I want people to know this, even if they didn't know it already. You did a ton of voiceover work when you were just a kid. And I remember growing up watching Johnny Quest on what was TV 44 in Chicago. That was you.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, there was a period when I was a kid actor and then I became a, you know, young adult actor. And that gap in between where I was really not working that much, I was sort of not fitting into either category. I fell into doing voice work for Johnny Quest at Hanna-Barbera. And I did Young Sinbad and Space Ghost and Young Samson. And Sinbad Jr. was the other one. And it was like a middle part of my career there. It was transitional. It was fantastic.
How did you get into all that? Was it your folks or was it something in an early age you wanted to do?
No, it was always me. And my mom was a single parent and she just, whatever I wanted to do, play baseball or anything like that. She just said, go for it. And, you know, I would just go out and try out for stuff.
That's cool. You also did, I mean, you did a ton of TV back then. You also did, like, Leave It to Beaver, My Three Sons, Adam 12. You did, I remember looking at your face and seeing this, and I said, God, that looks like Tim Matheson. You must have been 10 or 12 years old. You did an episode of The Twilight Zone, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Now, I don't know if I made the final cut, because I was, I think it was one of my first jobs. I was probably like 12, 13. And I was the younger version of a man who was trying to keep up with his younger wife. So he was taking this new drug, and he took too much of it, and it regress him down to being a baby. And I was in a 12.
That's pretty cool. Did you meet Rod Sterling at that time? Because I know you did a night gallery too.
I met him then. He was there shooting the, you know, those wraparounds he did on the show, and I just remember him chain smoking like crazy.
Yeah. He smoked on the show, I think. I mean, I think you saw a cigarette. You saw smoke coming up when he was doing his transitions. Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah, that was back in the day when smoking wasn't bad for you.
Yeah, right. That's right. And then, you know, you worked in, did some great film work too. You did Divorce American Style. And then you worked next, I mean, you've had a list of legendary stars you've worked with. Lucille Ball and Henry Fonda, yours, mine, and ours. How cool was, looking back at that, must have been surreal.
Well, it was a master class, you know. Here I am with Lucy, who came out of vaudeville, and Van Johnson, Tom Bosley, but Hank Fonda was one of the most amazing actors. He was just so focused, so relaxed, so prepared. And between Lucy and he, it was like, this is the way to do this.
Oh,
so
yeah.
At that young age, to, you know, work with people like that, that were so talented and so professional, it really was a life's course for me and how to do it.
I bet. She even had you back on Here's Lucy, her last sitcom in the early 70s, right?
Yeah. And she was tough. I mean, she really wanted you to get your come in prepared. You had to be loud.
Is that right?
I can't hear him. Speak up. Neil Gordon told me, he said, she was yelling at Richard Burton last week to speak up.
Oh, man. Wow. Yeah, she ran that show, though. I mean, she was, you know, people look at her, obviously, as obviously classic comedian in some of the best sitcoms in television history, but she was a businesswoman. Yeah. She was a businesswoman, and she ran that show after she divorced Desi. I mean, it was all her.
She, you know, when we started Yours, Mine, and Ours, she had just sold Desi Lu to Paramount,
right.
Gulf Western, I believe, and for like $20 million, which is probably close to $1 billion now.
Something like that.
And
yeah.
She was the first female studio executive, you know. And that's quite often overlooked.
Now, you were doing some other TV. You did Bonanza. You did Hawaii Five-0 with Kurt Russell, I saw. And then came Animal House, which was really groundbreaking, broke the mold of comedy. And as you said, it was your first major comedy role.
Yeah. I had been playing all these parts, like in Adam 12 and Hawaii Five-0, and I'd done my Westerns. And then I was playing like the Boy Next Door, this and that, and I was just sick of these nice guy parts. And so I joined an improv group, the Groundlings, here in L.A.
Yeah.
to learn how to do comedy, improv comedy. And then I just kept banging on the door to get in Animal House after I read this script. And they didn't want me. They said, no, he's a cowboy or a surfer or something, but he's not preppy.
Epic.
And I wangled an audition and got in there, and things worked out for me.
Well, you know, and John Belushi was on SNL, and he, you know, the thing was they were recruiting a lot of SNL people to be in this movie, and it really ended up just being John as far as that was concerned.
Well, the director, John Landis, didn't want Chevy and Danny Aykroyd and Harold and those people all around him because they thought he wanted it to be real actors around Belushi, which would keep him more grounded,
mm-hmm.
so that it didn't just get silly and you know. And so he was taking those baby steps. I mean, you know, the Caddyshack was the next one,
right?
Which was a little farther out, a little broader comedy, more Saturday Night Live, and it worked pretty well as well. But not as they hit his Animal House.
Right. No, not at all. And I don't think a lot of people really know this, but wasn't the movie shot in like 5 weeks, 6 weeks, something like that?
You got it. Yeah, 5 weeks, 1 week rehearsal. And the week's rehearsal was really nothing about reading the script. It was just the Deltas hanging out together to know each other and build a camaraderie.
And in that 5 weeks, Belushi, he was still on SNL, I think, at the time, and he was only there a few days a week, right?
That's right. He'd come in, he'd come in on the weekend, he'd come in on Sunday, work with us Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, fly back to New York Wednesday night, and then Thursday, Friday, Saturdays, he would rehearse and then do Saturday Night Live. And we'd all watch it. Eugene, and then Bruce McGill, who played D-Day, and I would pick him up at the airport on Sunday afternoon and take him back to his house with Judy, his wife.
Wow. Yeah, because this was filmed. Where was this filmed? Was it in a university on the West Coast in, like, 77, right?
Yes.
Oregon.
Oregon.
Yeah.
The only school that would let us in.
I guess so. Was it the off season? I mean, was it school out at that time, or were you there on campus when there was kids everywhere?
Oh no, there were people, there were students there. We showed up the day after Halloween.
Oh.
And stayed until December 7th or 6th. And it rained every day. Well, at some point, not all day, but 20 minutes here, an hour there.
Wow. And so that there you have, you're actually in the atmosphere of a college university, which might have helped a little bit. So was everything done at the university, or was some of this stuff done on a soundstage?
No, we built a couple of sets inside warehouses, and we shot inside a halfway house, was the interior of the fraternity house. But everything was a practical location, pretty much. I think they built Otter's room, Larry Kroger's room, and a couple of other things like that. But the dean's office was the dean's office, I think.
That's cool.
You had to get permission to get the horse in there.
Yeah, I bet you did. I bet you did. The cast, honestly, is so legendary, Tim. I mean, honestly, it just legendary. And I know you've talked about John Belushi before. You've always said he was a gracious guy, always to you.
Yeah. Yeah, he was he was very generous, supportive, and caring, and a loving guy to me and almost everybody around him. And he showed me Chicago. When we were promoting the movie, I was there with him a couple of times.
Sure.
And, he couldn't have been more gracious. You know, that it changed over time. As he got to be a bigger star, when we worked together again on 1941,
he
was still great to me, but there was so much going on and so many people wanted a piece of him.
Yeah.
You know, the drugs started taking over and it was a tremendous loss for me to, what a good friend.
Of course. Of course. But you made a lot of friends on the set. I mean, there's people that have been lifelong friends of yours from this experience.
Well, yeah. Yeah. I mean, Bruce McGill was the best man at my wedding back in 1985.
Cool.
And that lasted 25 years. That was good. Jamie Widows is a pal and who's a wonderful television director. I think he does Mom and to 2.5 Men he did. And
that's cool.
And the Big Bang. So he's really very successful. And up until recently, Stephen First was a pal, too.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I have to say, I've seen the movie a million times, like so many others, and I have a 17-year-old son, and we sat down. He was a year away from college, and we sat down and watched the film, and I think we did it back in January. Together, to watch it together was fabulous. And
right.
Then, I think he has introduced that movie to multiple groups of friends. Like, that's the go-to movie. We have a little movie room at the house that he is, like, I keep hearing scenes from the house. Loves, loves, loves this movie. And to think about, it's 40 years old, Tim. I mean, this still translates to other generations because it was a period piece. I mean, it was about the 60s, but
yes.
Still today.
The Harold Ramis and Doug Kenny and Chris Miller, the brilliance of what they did was to make it a 62 period so that it didn't get locked in the 70s. And it was an idyllic time.
And it's something that transcends time, because every, like your son, like every generation that's heading to college sits down and discovers the movie.
Yeah.
And they just go nuts for it. My kids never knew about this movie until they got to college. My
really?
Daughter that went down to UMiami in Florida called me one day and said, "Dad, I'm at a toga party. Say hi to my friends."
That's awesome. So what do they say to Dad, seeing you so young and all these in these great films? I mean, do they enjoy it? Do they kind of look at you and go, "Holy cow, Dad, you're a cool guy now"?
Yeah, it ups my cred.
Yeah, I bet it does. I bet it does. And now, you know, when I think about this, you know, you watch that movie, you can watch Old School, you know, which is generationally later. When you think about some of the situations in Animal House, in the film, they are still to this day, again, laugh out funny. But would some of that stuff pass the muster of our very unfortunate world of over-political correctness now?
Oh, no. No, it's, you know, it's misogynistic, it's sexist, it's racist.
Yeah.
But it gives as good as it gets. And that was the great thing about the Lampoon. It was outrageous and racist and homophobic, but it was also funny. So if you're really, really funny and smart, you can get away with it.
Yeah, but people, but had to know.
And they didn't hide from it, you know. They flaunted walking that edge.
But that's what it was supposed to be. It was supposed to be funny.
Right?
You weren't supposed to be crossing that line. Exactly. Or you were supposed to be crossing that line when watching any of the films or reading any of the content. When the Delta Brothers walked into the bar in the all black club, the studio was the studio was a bit concerned about that back then, right? They thought it was racist.
Oh, they did. The head of the studio said, "Oh, you got to cut this scene." And they showed it to Richard Pryor, who was a big Universal star at this time. Wonderful, you know, a black comic and great actor. And he looked at the movie and said, "White people are crazy. This is okay. It's funny."
They got his blessing.
Yeah.
They got his blessing on that. And again, doing this all in 5 weeks is what is still unbelievable to me. And you haven't stopped working. I mean, I've seen you in West Wing. I saw you in that Ronald Reagan biopic, by the way.
Oh.
That was fabulous.
Thank you.
Killing Reagan. Yeah. You know, it wasn't really a pure imitation, but it certainly was capturing who he was. What did you do to prepare for that? Like, did you watch old films? What did you do to prepare to play him?
Yes, I did watch a lot of old films and newsreels. And I mostly listened to all of his speeches and all his, and just constantly was doing that. But I wanted more to find the inside of the guy, the heart of the man, rather than do an impression of him.
Yeah.
And I just wanted it to be enough like him that people went, "Oh yeah, I get it. And, you know, I'm not a mimic or one of those impressionists, so. I felt it was really the right way to go, because I played Jack Kennedy in a miniseries once, and I was so preoccupied with his voice and his mannerisms that I wasn't happy with the work I did in it. So I took this a different way.
Different, yeah. Well, brilliant work. It was fabulous.
Thank you.
You just did a stint on CBS's The Good Fight. What else you got coming up, Tim?
Well, a couple of movies. I'm doing a movie with Dante Spinotti, who's a wonderful cinematographer, producer. His son and daughter-in-law have are directing a movie I'm doing here. A couple of other features I've done, and one called Six Balloons, and which is a film about drug addiction. So I'm staying as busy as I can, and in the meantime, I got married and building a house and starting a third act in my life.
Very cool. Very cool. Tim Matheson, again, Animal House turns 40 at the end of the month. Great time to celebrate and watch it again. Laugh out loud funny. You were fabulous in that. Pleasure talking to you, Tim. Appreciate it.
James, great talking to you, sir, but I really appreciate it.
No problem. All right, take care, pal.
See ya.
All right. It's 720 WGS.
Do you want to dance?
Yeah!
I have arrived here from the ghetto myself. Thank you very much. I'm here on the exchange program. Y'all can imagine what they sent over there. People always ask me about the ghetto. People ask me, hey, Jim, how can y'all live in the ghetto with all those cockroaches and everything like that? I think cockroaches are probably the cleanest animals on earth. Really, because every time you see them, they're in a bathtub. Dig this. Little old lady's walking down the street. She falls down. And in a great Yule time tradition, she laid there for a full 5 minutes before somebody snatched her pocketbook.
All right, it's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. Legendary actor and comedian Jimmy Walker has a new upcoming stand-up special with Michael Winslow called We're Still Here, debuting on Tuesday, August 7th on Amazon, Comcast, DirecTV, AT&T, Dish, Spectrum, iTunes, Charter, Google Play, and many other platforms. The new album complementing the new special will be released on Friday, August 10th. He rose to fame on the stand-up circuit, 5 seasons on Norman Lear's Good Times, and radio runs through his blood. And to talk about it all, Jimmy Walker joins us tonight. Welcome in, Jimmy.
Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule.
Oh, not busy. Never busy for you, sir. Absolutely not. Nice to have you with us. Very excited about this new special. Tell us a little bit about what's happening.
Well, you know, Brian Folk's wife, the guy who's producing, we've been trying to get a special with him or his partner there, Scott Montoya, for about 10 years. And they do specials in big clumps, bulk specials. So what happened was they had this their schedule all set up to do, you know, another bulk of 10 people, and some people dropped out. And, and then people kept dropping out. So I kind of fell to it, and because of my old Carson days, you know, when I was doing the Johnny Carsons and all that kind of stuff, the Merv Griffins and Mike Douglas's, I always stay ready. So I was totally prepared to do a special. We're not even doing like a full special. This is only a half hour. We probably have another, oh, heck darn it, another hour, hour and a half of stuff. But we always stay ready.
I love it. That's cool. That's very cool. And you're going to be all over, I mean, every digital platform, quite frankly. I mean, that's pretty cool.
We'll see if anybody takes time out to take a look at it. We'll see.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, you know, and stand-up, Jimmy, has been such a big part of your life for over 50 years. But, and I've read your book, too.
Oh, thank you. That's important. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Well, radio runs through your blood. I mean, you've been doing radio on and off for decades.
Decades. I kind of quasi-started in radio back in New York. For a brief period of time, I worked at LS there, your rival.
Yep.
You know, so radio is great. I love talk, and we'll see what happens. You know, you listen to Talkers Magazine, you never know.
That's right. That's right.
Michael Harrison, you don't know what he's going to say next.
I love it. I love it. Well, you know, and looking back, you know, at stand-up and really when you first started, legendary comedian Dick Gregory used to come on the Merv Griffin show all the time, and he had a book out that you read cover to cover, and it kind of really inspired you to pursue comedy and say to yourself, yeah, I can do this.
Yeah, Dick Gregory, who's actually a Chicago native, well, yep. St. Louis native, but spent a lot of time
Midwest.
In Chicago.
Yep.
Dick's book, which is the N-word, you can't say it anymore now. In those days, you could. Dick's book was just excellent. It's really actually one of the rare first books that I ever read in my life.
Yeah.
So I read it from cover to cover, and Dick was a major influence on me. Unfortunately, he just passed away about a year and a half ago.
Yep, yep.
And I think, you know, comedy since then has changed drastically. I'm actually... I appreciate you, oh, heck darn it, reading my book, because you're the one, I guess, who read it.
Yeah, it was just me.
Just you. You're the only one. We have like probably have 5,000 stacked up in my garage.
Oh, boy.
But it's like 499. I go, hey, some guy in Chicago read it. All right. We got rid of one.
You got rid of one. It was me.
But I'm actually writing a new book now, which is really reflects a lot on society. And what it is about the Great American Divide. That's the name of the book.
Yeah.
There's a Great American Divide and dash, dash, dash comedy. And comedy has divided our country. So I think when people are looking for answers to our social ills, we can look directly toward comedy.
And honestly, that's the one place that should be a little more sacred, because we're, you know, out there to make people laugh and entertain, and people take everything the wrong way now. So, I mean, it's just so difficult to even tell a joke to somebody
these days. I think we're at a point now, you know, comedy is divided into racial, woman, sexual things, where when I started, you know, if you saw Flip Wilson, I saw Flip Wilson. If you saw Alan King, I saw Alan King. That's no longer the case today. It's all changed drastically, and it's changed to the point that we're divided racially. Mel Brooks said, had a great line. He said, "Funny is funny." Well, funny isn't funny anymore.
Yeah.
Because Jim Gaffigan funny is much different than Cat Williams funny.
Yeah.
So more funny is much different than Amy Schumer funny.
Yeah. But, you know, even, you know, you talk about different comedians kind of for different people. Very early on, you were kind of, and you've said this before, you were kind of the angry black guy thing. And at some point, you know, you had people around you that said, you know, we got to make you a little bit more mainstream so we can get you on some other shows. And I know at some point, late comedian David Brenner became kind of a mentor for you. How did you know David, and how did that all come together?
David Brenner is like my big brother.
Yeah.
So he, you're obviously Jewish, says, you know, Jews have gone through at least as much as black people. And he showed me the way to try to become more commercial. As it stands now, I'm not an urban comedian. It's funny because when owners see me, they think I'm going to be urban, and I'm not. You know, I always call myself the Johnny Mathis of black comedians. So,
well, I mean, watching you on Letterman for years, I mean, and watching you do stand up there, I certainly never felt that way. I mean, to me, comedy's comedy. You know,
it used to be, but it's not. I think the minority comics get away with much more than the white comics. A perfect example, if you watch any urban comic, any black comic or any Hispanic comic, there will always be a line in there to go, you know, white people are so stupid, or white people have credit, or white people this or that. Now, okay, we have that premise, and that always gets a laugh whenever anybody does. But let's say Jeff Foxworthy got on and says, you know, I hate black people. Private jet's gone. No more private school for his kids.
Oh, yeah.
It's all over.
Oh, yeah.
So urban comics can get away with that, whereas white comics can't. And that's why you probably won't see any, you know, except for on the Trump thing. And now we've gotten onto this bag, you know, except for the Trump thing, you won't see many cutting edge white comics if they don't have the subjects to deal with.
No, they're afraid. I mean, honestly, it's become a point of afraid of just losing everything. And that's a shame. You were mentioning Mel Brooks, what he had said about the funny. You know, he's also said that political correctness has killed comedy.
Well, speaking of Mel, you could never do Blazing Saddles today. That would never even fly. I'm going to a thing in the next week or so for Norman Lear, and he's a guy who I think Norman would have the guts to do what he does, but I'm not sure that the networks would fly with an All in the Family or anything like that. Our society is very divided, and it's strange because I've said it in my new book, that will sell maybe a half a copy.
I'll buy it. I'll get it. I'll pick it up.
it's we live in parallel universes.
Yeah.
You know, if you walk out there on Mish Ave where you guys are, you will see minorities walking around, but you won't see the relate of people. People don't relate to each other anymore. By this I mean you can go to your favorite spot after 8 o'clock on Mish Ave, like you got minorities working there at GN, whatever, and you guys talk and whatever. But after 8 o'clock, you will see no hanging out. And by that I mean going to any bar, see how many times you see a white guy, black guy, Hispanic guy, just hanging out, friends. You won't see it. It just we're not friends, and that's just the way it is. You know, you'll see interracial couples, but you'll never see
the majority of people, and you guys are big Bear fans and the whole deal there. And all week long at the station, you talk about the Bears and everything. But on Sunday, when you go to watch the Bears, you will not see people of different likes, different kinds, hanging out together. And then on Monday, you'll come back and you'll talk about how the Bears lost and why Mr. Trubisky stinks or whatever. But you will never hang out together. And that's what I'm saying. We just aren't friends. We don't relate to each other. Only at work. That's the only time. And that's the law. You know, you have to have a certain amount of minorities hang out together at work because it's the law. You got to have, you know, your number, whatever. Otherwise, human resources goes berserk.
I think that might be true. I think that might be true of some people, probably not all. But, I mean, you also look back to...
It's never all, but it's the majority.
Yeah.
You know, and by that I mean 80 to 85%. And I would dare your crowd to say, because you're tough, so you won't have a heavy minority audience at GN. But I dare your crowd to say, let me be able to call somebody of another race right now, and let's go, you know, have a drink tonight at 8 o'clock. Let's see how many can do that.
But do you think that is...
It's on both sides.
But do you think that's come full circle? Because, I mean, okay, when you started in the business in the 60s and early 70s, it might have been that way. I think it evolved over time. I mean, do you think then now, because of what's happening politically, like it just has all snapped back almost 40, 50 years ago? I mean, is that kind of what you're saying?
I think that in the 60s, people actually sought people out. People sought people out because you were supposed to, you know, people wanted to hang out with different likes. That was the first time actually on basically on an equal level that we all got together. Because, and that was led, quite honestly, by white people, the Joan Baezes and those kind of people like that. And then people want, and the Vietnam War was a major contention at that time, back when I started. And that, as strange as it sounds, united people.
Well, and you mentioned you're doing something with Norman Lear. Do you think some of the, I mean, think about the All in the Families, think about the Good Times and all that other stuff. You know, he's rebooted One Day at a Time with a Hispanic cast. It's been very successful. But do you think that you could put on an All in the Family today or a Good Times today for that matter?
I think an All in the Family would not work at all.
Yeah.
You know, they tried it again with the Jerry Carmichael show in a black cast with David Allen Greer.
Right. Yeah, that's right. Yep.
And it didn't work whatsoever. I think people are too sensitive about everything. I mean, everything offends somebody. And it makes comedy very, very difficult with the whole deal. I mean, you look at the Big Bang Theory or something like that, you have to be that generic nowadays. Mm-hmm. And I love Big Bang. I think Jim Parsons, every year for me, deserves an Emmy for carrying that show. I love his work. Reminds me a lot of myself.
It does remind me of your role. Okay, I was going to say that. What he does and what he contributes to that show is kind of how I saw your contribution to Good Times. And you got a lot of crap for what you did on Good Times from even your cast members of how you approached it.
I think that we took an unbelievable amount of heat, you know, for whatever. I never really understood it. I never really got it. But what it did was it eliminated ethnic shows for 10 years.
It did. Okay.
Because the networks did not want to do any ethnic shows.
Yeah,
they'll do dramas now, but comedy they won't do really because they're afraid to offend people. And it's been generational. You know, Cosby, when he did his show, which was excellent, he wanted to do it as the Honeymooners.
Yeah.
And it was 10 years after our show, and the network said, absolutely not, because, minorities are going to be offended that they're not rich black people. So they made them as out of touch with what black lives are as possible. I'm sure there's some minorities who are like the Cosbys, but that's not the majority.
Well, even
and now they're doing now. My line has always been, because of our show, you will never see a poor black family ever again in a sitcom on TV. Ever again.
And let me tell you, that show was nominated for Emmys, Golden Globes. You won an Emmy for your role.
I mean, so think
about that. I mean, you were honored for what you did back in the 70s.
Well,
We won things there, and we actually won a BET award, which I would never be. They would never invite me ever again to their thing, the Black Entertainment Television. But I think that we're so sensitive, and like I said, I think we're coming to the end of our society as we knew it and as we know it, and it's going to be it's becoming worster and worster. And I think even in the political vein, the civility is unbelievably negative. I mean, I don't care where your political belief, whether you're Trump or whatever the hell it is, but when you see that Sarah Huckabee Sanders can't go out to eat, that's ridiculous. When you see people not even criticize Maxine Waters for saying, go get anybody you can from the Trump administration. I think that's out of line. You can say, I disagree with you, I don't agree, and you bring your points up. Even my girl Whoopi Goldberg, and I love Whoopi, she's fabulous. I mean, if she doesn't agree with Jeanine Pirro, fine. You know, she can say it in a debate form, which they're in that form every day. But the treatment was a little rough there. You know, you can say, I disagree with everything you say, and here's why I disagree with it. It's terrible, it's stupid. Okay, fine, no big deal. But I think civility has left our society just out of whack.
Yeah.
And I think it's getting more worster and worster by the minute.
Yeah. And how do you get that back? I mean, you almost have to avoid the conversation. I hate to say it, but I know politically where I stand. I know politically where friends stand. I won't even talk about it with them because I just want to go out to dinner and enjoy each other's company and have a good time. You almost got to steer clear if you're going to have a normal conversation with somebody.
Yeah, I think that we're really at that point where people, like me, I have 3 TVs in my room. And, you know, when I go to the hotel, I try to get 3 TVs. And what it is, it's getting to a point that you watch the same story being covered by the 3 networks. And the difference is daunting. It's it's covered so differently now. And it's just amazing.
It's not news, but it's not news anymore. It's entertainment. Like, where are you going to go to find just the facts? It's a tough place. It's a tough place to find something like that, where you're just looking for factual information without infiltrated with opinion.
I also think, unfortunately, and this is going to sound awful, we're part of the problem. We're part of the problem too, because there may be, and this is going to sound awful because you're on the air, and I love to be on the air when I get the shot. There may be too much media. Because anybody with any sort of whatever can just post anything they want and start a Twitter war, and it starts. We didn't have that 40 or 50 years ago.
No.
And it could be, and I know this is going to sound sacrilegious, it could be a possibility of too much media. And I'm not talking about the ABCs, NBC, CBS, MSNBC, Fox, CNN. I'm talking about just the network kind of malaise that's happening out there. It's unbelievable in social media. I mean, it's become hellish, actually, social media. Too much.
Yeah, agree. And I think that's what's lighting all the fires, obviously, in our society today.
Yeah, I think that is it. And like I said, I put it in my book, which, you know, I'm still begging for somebody to buy a copy when I finally get it out there. You know, but comedy has changed everything.
Yeah.
And you'll see it if you watch Netflix. And I'm sure Brett Hastings, who's never a Jimmy Walker fan, who's the president of Netflix, is saying, good, more reasons not to hire you. But if you look at the specials, you'll see tonight is Black Night. It's, you know, we're getting down. Tonight is local comedy night, local crazy comedy. Tonight is gay night. It's so focused. There's no such thing as, tonight is comedy.
Just comedy,
night.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's all over.
Well, I'm glad you're doing this special. We're still here, debuting Tuesday, August 7th on Amazon, Comcast, DirecTV, AT&T, Dish, Spectrum, iTunes, Charter, Google Play. You're going to find it all over the place. The new album about the new special will be released on Friday, August 10th. And for more on Jimmy, you can visit JimmyWalkerDynamite.com. I'm looking forward to the special, but I think you've had some pretty interesting insights in all of this, and you're one of the rare people that talks about it publicly, because I think we're all thinking it. I don't think we're all talking about it. Some pretty interesting insight.
Well, thanks for having me on, and I'm sure I'll get my minute and a half on your big show. Long conversation. I heard you for a minute on
I'm not taking anything out of here. That was a great conversation. I appreciate it, Jimmy. Thanks again.
Okay, thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
All right, take care. All right, news is next on 720 WGN.
Frankie Avalon and Annette Funicello. Two youngsters in love you'll love.
You know, the only thing I've studied this semester is you.
Well, I hope you don't flunk.
Kisses and my arms, a girl with all the charms of you.
All right, it's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. If you can't remember a time when music legend Frankie Avalon wasn't part of your life, well, you're not alone. As one of America's first teen idols, his career has spanned three generations of music, television, and motion pictures. Venus was Avalon's biggest hit, selling more than a million copies in the spring of 1959, not to mention hitting the big screen with such hits as John Wayne's Alamo, the surfing craze that led to leading roles in Beach Party, Beach Blanket Bingo, and years later in the movie Grease, which is celebrating its 40th anniversary this year. Now, he's currently one of the busiest nightclub performers playing Vegas and headlining in entertainment venues throughout the country. And Frankie will be at the Arcata Theater this Sunday, March 18th at 3 p.m. And I'm thrilled that Frankie Avalon joins us tonight. Good evening, Frankie.
Thank you, Dave. Nice talking with you.
I was remiss to not mention your appearance on Happy Days that I remember growing up as a kid. You were on you were on an episode. I remember
you know, that. Yeah, that was a lot of fun, of course, doing that show, which was, of course, very apropos for the 50s, and I was part of it. So it kind of worked very well.
Yeah, it did. It absolutely did. Well, let me tell you, very, very excited you're joining us. You are a legend in the music industry. And, you know, I'm looking back at really how you got started in all this. And I know very early on as a kid, you were interested in performing. And it was your father that taught you how to play the trumpet, correct?
I picked it up pretty quickly. Of course, I practiced 5 to 7 hours a day. I just loved the horn and had an opportunity to show the country that I could play that horn pretty well. And I did the Jackie Gleason show twice. And
I know, that's crazy. In the early 50s, right? It was like 52,
yeah,
53?
Yeah, I was on the Honeymooners. As a matter of fact,
wow.
Someone told me it's on YouTube or something. You can get it, the Jackie Gleason show, and where I even did some tap dancing and played the trumpet. So
I think, okay, so
know,
I think I saw it.
Time, I guess.
That was a Christmas episode maybe of the Honeymooners, wasn't it? One of them anyway?
Gee, I really don't remember, so many years ago, but
wow.
I remember doing it and really having a good time doing it.
That's very cool. How did you go from trumpet to singing? Like, what was the needle that moved that?
Well, you know, when I got older and, of course, started playing with bands and summertime came around, I was playing with a group. And the group was called Rocco and the Saints, and I was mm-hmm. one of the Saints. And I played trumpet and did a little singing. And it just so happened that there was a new record company coming along, and they were looking for new young talent. And our band was very popular in the seashore area of Atlantic City and those places there. And they came in, heard the band, liked it, and signed us to a contract. And on one side of the first record we did was an instrumental called Jivin' with the Saints.
Yep,
and
yep.
The other side was called Cupid Shot an Arrow, and I did the vocal on that. That started me in singing.
And your first songs were, you know, were kind of aimed at teens. And I know one of the other, you know, you talked about the Honeymooners being like a first national audience as a trumpet, but as a singer, I think it was Teacher's Pet in a movie, wasn't it?
Yeah, what happened was, again, if you ever get to see that clip called Jamboree, I had the very last billing along with Rocco and the Saints featuring Frankie Avalon. And as a matter of fact, the introduction to me on screen is a recording studio, and one of the actresses comes in and says his name is Frankie Avalon. I mean,
wow.
It was a brand new name. Yeah. So I was still with Rocco and the Saints there, and I think they paid us $700
not bad.
To do the movie, and we drove in from Philadelphia, that was my first attempt at movie making.
Well, as I say, you grew up in Philadelphia, where the music scene, honestly, was so hot in the 1950s, coming from that town. From that city.
Yeah, I mean, Philadelphia, for years and years and years and decades, has been really a part of the music industry. Going back to Mario Lanza, to Eddie Fisher, to Buddy Greco, to Hall & Oates, I mean, Philly, you can go on and on. And a lot of the new singers that are on the charts today are from Philadelphia.
Yeah.
If you go look at where they're born, you know, so it's always produced a lot of music people.
So tell me a little bit about Bob Marcucci.
Bob Marcucci was, when I mentioned the fact of a brand new record company, he and his partner Pete DeAngelis started this record company, and not only did they start the record company, but they became our manager, and then my manager, and then they started writing the songs. They were, as a matter of fact, my first hit that hit the top five, really was a song called Dee Dee Dinah, and that was written by the two fellas who owned the record company, which was Bob Marcucci and Pete DeAngelis. They also wrote the song Why, which was the last number one song that ended the decade of the 50s. It was number one. So, you know, they were very instrumental in my career. They believed in me, and they thought I had something that the kids wanted at the time, and apparently they were right, because I became very successful.
Well, you trusted them, too, which was critically important as an artist back then. But Dee Dee Dinah, you did not like that song. That was not one of your favorites.
No. And the way I did it when I was in the recording session, in those days there were only two tracks. So you had the band on one track and you had the singer, the vocalist on the other track. And I was just fooling around with it. It was very staccato to me. And being a musician, I studied with the Rosenfeld of the Philadelphia Orchestra. So I was really involved into music.
Yeah.
And it sounded very staccato. And I started to sing it like that as we were rehearsing. And they were really just rehearsal with the band. And the producer, who was Pete DeAngelis, said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I don't know. It just sounds very staccato to me." And bah, 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 bah. So I started doing it. He said, "Let's make a few takes like that. It's got a sound, you know."
It does.
In those days, a gimmick was a sound, and you know, they put it out. I couldn't believe it, but it came out, and it was a top five record, and started my career.
Now, do you remember hearing yourself on radio for the first time? Because radio, and it still is to a degree, but radio was the driver of everything. I mean, you discovered new music listening to the radio.
Oh, yeah. Well, as a matter of fact, it became, when I first heard my voice and my song on the radio, I made sure I pulled over on the side and listened to the whole thing.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
That's cool. No, that's very cool. Yeah. And I don't think many people really remember this, but Philadelphia is where Dick Clark's American Bandstand originated from before it went national. And you were one of the rising stars that appeared on Bandstand, and you were interviewed by Dick Clark, and you kind of credit him a little bit for really throwing you out there.
Yeah, well, you know, Dick Clark was very professional. The only reason why or way you got on the Dick Clark show is if your record started to make some noise on the top 100 charts. And of course, my first couple of records, I was not on Dick Clark's show, being in Philadelphia, and everybody thought that I would be, but I didn't go on until Dee Dee Dinah hit the charts.
Right.
And as it started to go, then I followed up with other songs, and I don't know how many chart records in my career, but I know it's close to 20, I'm sure.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, some of your early hits also included Gingerbread, which sold a million copies. But
then
at some point,
Venus is a big record. I'll Wait for You was a nice song, Just Ask Your Heart. I mean, there were a lot of songs I did were chart records.
But then they started really presenting you. You were doing a lot of teen stuff, but then they started presenting you with some of those more mature songs that was beyond the teen audience. And you said Pete DeAngelis did all your records. He presented you with that arrangement for Venus, and you immediately fell in love with that song.
Oh yeah, just loved it, and I just knew that it would be a tremendous success if my fans took liking to it, which they did, and of course the world did, because it gave me an opportunity to sing in all countries, cultures of this wonderful world.
And you did seven takes on this song, and I had heard you say before that you waited almost all night for the tape because you wanted to walk away with that tape in your hand.
Yeah, I did.
Right?
I waited all night, as a matter of fact. Yeah. I got home about, it was a two-hour drive from New York. I recorded it in New York City, and I had a hi-fi record player. And I put it on there, and I played it for my folks and anybody who walked by my house, you know. I lived in a row house.
Yeah, yeah.
I just said, come listen to this, come listen to this, you know. And I'll never forget the interview that I did with Dick Clark. He had called me, said, I understand you've got a new record coming out. And I said that on the air. I said, Dick, if my fans like this record, it's going to be a tremendous success.
Well, you know, I saw you years ago at the Rosemont Theater in the stage version of Grease, and when you played that song, Without the Question, I mean, and every time, the crowd goes wild. I mean, that's the song, right?
Well, you're talking about Venus.
Yeah, Venus.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Well, that's my signature song, you know. I mean, one of my sons came in yesterday, said, Dad, did you know that your song is in another song of a rapper? I said, no, I have no idea.
Yeah.
But it is. I mean, it's a great song, and it's been, you know, it's been in movies, it's been on television, it's done commercials. It's just a great song.
Yeah, just make sure you get paid for that rap song. You're essentially one of the first teen idols. Did that, you know, how was that like at that time? Did that success ever go to your head? Did you know what to do with it at the time?
No, I couldn't believe what was happening to me. I mean, I was kind of a popular kid in school. If you look at the school book, I was best dressed, best looking, all this other stuff. But, you know, not anybody wanting to grab my hair or, you know, whatever. It was kind of an interesting thing. I never really took it seriously. I got the biggest kick out of it. You know, I thought it was just fun.
Boy, that's the secret behind all that, because you know, so many people have gone down a similar path and they've embraced it in a different way, and it's caused trouble for them. And so to take it a little lightly probably helped you in those years, you know?
Yeah, and you know, it just what happened because of my success as a teen idol, it got me the opportunity to go into motion pictures. I mean, I did my first film at Warner Brothers with Alan Ladd, and then the Alamo, and then I've made close to now 40 motion pictures, so it's been a career.
I know. You know, I was saying Alan Ladd was Guns of the Timberland. And then the surfing craze. I mean, that really took you into a whole different direction. So, you know, Beach Party, Muscle Beach, Beach Blanket Bingo, you really enjoyed your relationship and working with Annette,
too.
You know,
those pictures were such fun because we became like an ensemble.
Yeah.
From the first one on, Bill Asher, who was a wonderful director, great credits, and very talented. As a matter of fact, as a young man, he was doing the I Love Lucy show as a director.
He was
like 24, 25 years old.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they had to trust him, you know. So he was very talented, and we became an ensemble. And when I did, I was signed to American International Pictures, and I had made a couple of pictures. I made a picture with Ray Milland, who was an Academy Award winner, called Panic in Year Zero. And this little film came out and did tremendous success at the box office. And I got friendly with one of the writers, Lou Rosoff was his name. And I said, he used to come to my house, and we got to talking at one night. And I said, why don't you write something that's like a combination of the Dead End Kids, you know, the fun of a camaraderie of a group of kids and girls. And he, about a month later, came in with a script called Beach Party, and I thought it was terrific. And I said, who's going to play the character Dee Dee?
Right.
Well, we got this gal from Disney, Annette Funicello. I said, I know Annette Funicello. I used to date her.
No way. So, I didn't know that.
So that's how awesome. it started, because when that came out, Beach Party, it was a tremendous success. And because of that, we did 3-4 at a time. We made about 7 or 8 of them, you know.
And some of the other stars in here, I just got a kick out of it. And I talked to him about it a couple years ago when I interviewed Don Rickles. He was in that. Paul Lynn, Buster Keaton, Maury Amsterdam, Boris Karloff, Keenan Wynn, Terry Garr, and as you mentioned, Bill Asher, Elizabeth Montgomery made some appearances and some voiceovers as well. That must have been pretty surreal, surrounded by some of these other legendary stars of the day.
Well, I mean, I couldn't believe I would sit on the set and talk to, I don't know, every one that you mentioned and get stories from them. Buster Keaton, I mean, you want to talk about a legend. There's a man who had his own studio, who was revered as one of the finest comedians of any generation, you know?
Yeah.
And to sit and talk with Vincent Price and to sit and talk with Boris Karloff and all these guys that I, as a kid growing up, And they were wonderful, talented, and Ray Milland to work with him, an Academy Award winner, and Dorothy Malone, who just passed. I mean, all these people were just, wonderful to work with and great inspiration for me.
Well, I still think that America is still pretty obsessed with the 1950s and the 1960s as just such a throwback, retro, I would say, more than, I kind of look at the 30s and 40s as nostalgic. I look at the 50s and 60s as kind of a retro experience. And American Graffiti mm-hmm. was one of those first big films to highlight the rock and roll.
Yeah.
But then Grease came along, and that must have been a fun role for you.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's amazing, and no one ever thought, first of all, I turned the role down when it was first offered to me,
because
I'd seen the Broadway play. And the character of Teen Angel was, of course, on the stage. He came off of a rope and all in black and long sideburns, and he was an extension of Elvis, And when my manager came to me and said, they want you for this picture, and I said, what is Grease? I said, what role, Teen Angel? I said, pass.
Yeah.
And finally, he came back and he said, they won't take no, they want to meet with you. I said, okay. And I met with the producers and directors, and I said, hey, guys, I have my own style. I sing my way. I'm not an Elvis impersonator or anything like that. So they said, we'll change it.
Yeah.
So they put it all in white, and they had a piano player there, and I started to work on it with them, and I gave it my rendition, and they said, okay, let's do it.
Yeah, it had to be about you. I mean, it had to be your. It had to be who you were in the 1950s and 60s, and what your personality was all about. And I think that's what made that so special, seeing you there. And then, of course, I've seen you do it on the stage version as well. And I know you're kind of involved behind the scenes with the whole Grease Broadway production as well. But that must be fun too, because I think it's a surprise for a lot of people.
A great experience for me. I did it for a couple of years, and when they came to me to do that on stage, I said, listen, I just can't sing one song. I mean, I've got, fortunately, a lot of hit songs. So I did the old Al Jolson, you ain't heard nothing yet, sit down, kids. And
I know, I love that.
And I closed the show by doing Dee Dee Dinah and Gingerbread and Venus and say goodnight to everybody, so it worked out fine.
Yeah, what a treat. What a treat that was. Now, you've done movies, music, live performances. What do you enjoy the most?
I probably would have to say live performances.
Yeah, can't beat it.
Doing a motion picture is very tedious and demanding and a lot of hours. Where performances, it's now. Then here he is, and you walk out there, and you get a response, and you've got a rapport, and you sing, and you look at faces, and people are smiling and singing the songs and having a good time. I'd like to go into the audience and kind of reminisce with them. So I like that experience.
Well, I'll tell you what, looking very forward to you coming back to Chicago. Frankie will be at the Arcata Theater this Sunday, March 18th at 3 p.m. For tickets, of course, you want to visit ArcataLive.com. And for more on Frankie, he's got his own website. You can visit FrankieAvalon.com. Frankie, what an honor it's been speaking with you tonight.
Well, thanks, Dave, and I appreciate you telling everyone I'm going to be at the Arcata Theater with Ron Onesti, who I've been working with
great
for a
guy.
Lot of years. He's one of the great entrepreneurs of show business, and it's fun. It's a nice theater. It's warm and it's cozy.
Intimate.
Bring my son, who is my drummer, and I do a surprise with someone else that's in the show. And it's a fun time. And I love the fact, Dave, that it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
I do too. I think that's awesome. Well, we look forward to seeing you back in Chicago this weekend, pal.
Okay. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you, sir. All right. News is next on 720 WGN.